Hi, great. So, welcome to this Zoom discussion. Thank you again so much for supporting my work. As many of you know, I am in the process of transition. I have left my teaching job, and now I am trying to figure out what next steps are. I'll be doing a lot of traveling these next few months, and I will try to upgrade my Substack in order to build a stronger community. We will have monthly Zoom discussions just so that I have a chance to know who you are, and I can answer directly your questions about geopolitics, about anything really, to get to know my community a lot better and figure out what people are interested in learning about. I will also organize more meetups. So my first meetup will be in Tokyo on Tuesday, and I will return to North America in August, and I will organize meetups in the major cities, Toronto, New York, Los Angeles, Austin, among other cities. And yeah, so thank you again for everyone who is participating in tonight's conversation. I will switch time zones every month in order to include as many people as possible from different parts of the world. This is a chance not just for me to get to know you, but it's really a chance for me to learn about your part of the world, about your interests. And I'm really looking forward to this discussion tonight. So, are there any questions? I'm hoping this will be an interactive session. So, I'm hoping that you guys will ask questions, and I'll just respond with my thoughts. But are there any questions or comments? Does anyone want to raise his or her hand to begin? Hello, anyone?
I would like to.
Okay, yep. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Hi, Professor Jiang. Thank you for the Zoom meeting. So I'm just my question is a little bit general because with the very recent developments with Trump, his we go back to war situation. Obviously, apparently, he mentioned he still wants to talk to Iran, but the ceasefire is over, so the whole story continues there. But what are your thoughts now? Do you think they might then now start to get the ground troops going, or at least get the soldiers ready, so to say? Yeah, my English, I'm from Belgium, so I try to make it clear. So it's a bit general, I know, but it's just a startup, and it's with the recent information I got yesterday when I was checking the news.
Yeah, so I think for the next 2 to 3 months, you will have a lot of back and forth. There's gonna be some moments of intense warfare, like what's been happening these two days, and suddenly it will stop for a few more days. They will say the MOU is still in force, and then for whatever reason, we're back at war again. Okay, so I want to go over why this is happening. First of all, what's really important to appreciate is that the military leadership is now divided from the political leadership in Iran. So the political leadership are the ones who are negotiating the MOU. They're the ones who are trying to have a permanent ceasefire in order to maintain economic stability in their country. The military leadership, which is basically the IRGC, they have actual control of the Strait of Hormuz. And from their perspective, there's no point in an MOU. There's no point in a ceasefire because at least the Americans won't respect it anyway. So there's this dynamic going on where, on the surface, politically, Iran is still adhering to the MOU, but militarily, Iran is has decided to. That America and Israel will eventually invade, and so they need to prepare for this eventuality. Okay, that's point one. Point two is that Iran, the United States, and the Israelis are committed to war, but the world is going to suffer a great deal from this conflict. And so you have countries like China, especially China, but also India, Pakistan, the GCC, who are trying to apply as much diplomatic pressure as possible on the Iranians to agree to a ceasefire. It's impossible for the world to apply any pressures to the Israelis and the Americans. They don't care. So what they're doing is they're applying a lot of pressure on the Iranians to stop the war and open up the Strait of Hormuz. It's completely unfair to the Iranians because it's really the Americans and Israelis who are the aggressors. But unfortunately, the world, especially China and India, can only apply pressure to Iran. And China has a lot of leverage because China buys up 90% of Iranian oil. So the Iranians have absolutely no choice but to respect the Chinese desire to seek a political settlement as soon as possible. And so they only maintain this theater where, you know, on the surface, you're trying to come to a peaceful ceasefire as soon as possible. But they know that eventually Americans will send in ground troops, so they have to prepare for this eventuality, okay? That's the second point. And the third point is that the Americans have already decided on a ground invasion. The problem right now is it's too hot to send in troops. They've got 60,000 soldiers. They've got two aircraft carriers. They've got like 20 warships. So the ground invasion is being staged right now. But again, it's just too hot. Also, in a ground invasion, the Americans want to be the support force, right? So they basically want to send in the Kurds and other groups in the front line to draw out the IRGC so that it can be targeted by the by American air power. So the Americans need time to convince the Kurds to go in first. And they need time to stage an entire ground operation, which just means bringing logistics, preparing the soldiers, preparing the battlefield plan. But I would say they've already decided on a ground invasion. It will happen as early as October, possibly after the midterms. So a lot of what we're seeing right now is just theater. They're just trying to delay the inevitable. Okay, so I'm not sure if you have a follow-up question, Sarah. What was this clear?
I have just a follow-up question, sure. Professor. So because you mentioned China buys up a lot of oil, so they have that leverage. But we're seeing now after the first situation where they were like, oh, it's going to cost so much for the people because of the Strait of Hormuz. And in your last post in that article, you mentioned it, like now no one is talking about it. Everything stays the same price because there China went like probably did some bargaining to lift the pressure actually for the public of the world. What do you think is the development? Is that the same path they're going to keep going until the ground invasion in the second part of the year goes and then we're going to feel it more? Or that's my follow-up question.
Yeah, so I think one really important thing we need to keep in mind is the people in charge right now do not do long-term thinking. They don't do long-term strategy. For them, it's all about short-term benefit, right? So Trump does not want the price of oil to skyrocket because then the American public will freak out. So he's made a deal with a lot of people, but the Chinese, but also the Iranians, the Russians, right? So he's basically allowing the Iranians to sell oil, to dump oil in the market, primarily to the Chinese. He's got the Chinese to promise him to lower demand and control their own supply. That's what he's doing. You know, he thinks he's a deal maker. He thinks, you know, it's the art of the deal and he can get everyone on the table and agree on a plan. But the reality is that the world needs oil. It needs cheap oil from the Middle East. It is impossible to substitute cheap oil from the Middle East with Venezuela oil or Russian oil or American oil. And so in a few weeks' time, you will see a massive global emergency, which will include food shortages, which will include inflation, which will include the price of oil skyrocketing, okay? So all Trump is doing is delaying the inevitable. right? So
Really.
I appreciate that a lot of what's happening is confusing, but basically what they're doing is they're trying to kick the can down the road, if that makes sense. Okay.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Thank you
Okay.
very much, Professor.
So thank you so much, sir. So Leandro, could you ask your question or make your comment, please?
Hello, Professor. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You sound great.
Great. Yeah, so great to be here on the call. First of all, thank you very much for your lectures these past few months. So what I'm curious about is, in the media, like these last few years with the rise of certain influencers, like how do you view that rise of influencers like even you've talked to Sneakle on a few calls as well, obviously. How do you kind of see the rise of these influencers who promote young men to be like, yeah, you need to be more masculine, you need to make more money, get fit and strong and all of that. Do you view, is that kind of a natural occurrence, you think, or is it also more like an industry planned in a way, if you understand my question?
Sure, I understand. Yeah, so I mean, we've seen a lot of influencers these past 10 years that have skyrocketed to fame, right? Who speak to young men. The most obvious example is Jordan P Peterson. And Jordan Peterson was able to capture the imagination of young men, especially young white men, because at this time in history, in this year, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, right? Especially these 4 years, DEI, woke politics, progressive politics has basically taken over the American, Canadian, Western school system. And young men were taught that masculinity was toxic and that they were the real problems in society. And a lot of people, especially from my minority groups, were being promoted in schools. And we have to keep in mind that in the school system, especially at the primary school level, most teachers are women teachers. And women teachers tend to prefer or advantage a certain student that is obedient, that is focused, that is diligent. And these tend to be more, th this tend to benefits more girls than boys, okay? I mean, the reality is, if you look at statistics, girls do a lot better in school than boys. So I think like the ratio in university right now, like if like it's a, I think it's like 60-40, right? I have 60% of all students in university right now are female and 40% are male. It could be 55-45, but there's a clear advantage for women students over men students. And so it's very confusing if you're a young white man, because in your world, it seems the women have all the advantage, right? But you've been taught that you're the problem in society. It's your masculinity that is the problem in society. And this also ties into how people, especially young kids, are oversubscribed or over prescribed medication, right? So if you happen to like have questions or you run around too much, they diagnose you as ADHD. And they make you take Ritalin or something, and that's just destroying the psychology of young men. And I have two boys, and I think it's one of the things that they run around, that they roughhouse, that they ask questions, that they disobey me. I think that's just part of the growing up process. So I think that young men, especially young white men, feel extremely disadvantaged, feel extremely discriminated against in society, but they could not articulate these concerns because their teachers, their parents, all these authority figures told them that they were the problem. And that's why someone like Jordan Peterson is such a breath of fresh air, right? And then the Tate brothers come along. And look, the reality is that if you're a young person, I'm not just saying like young white man, I'm just saying that if you're just a young person, you're completely screwed over. Because the baby boomers have all the wealth, they have all the political power, and they're not dying. So there's really no social mobility in society. So I think because all these like social economic factors, because all this discrimination against young men in society, the Tate brothers, Nick Fuentes, Jordan Peterson, they all give voice to these people. And I think, look, I think it's a great thing like there's more debate in society. I think it's a great thing that there are more voices in society. So it's unfortunate that what's happened is that the debate has become much more siloed and marginalized. What I mean by that is you're not, you're like, you before when I was growing up, it was important to engage people's arguments. Now it's just like, well, I don't like who you are. I don't like who you represent. So I will now just ignore you. Okay. So deplatforming, cancel culture have become very, very common. And all this does is feed the appetite for people like Jordan Peterson, Nick Fuentes, the Tate brothers, even more. So those are my thoughts. Do you have any more questions, LeAngelo?
Yeah, like basically, so it's have to sum it up. It's kind of like because of the like these last few decades that people have that young men have become kind of
Thank you so much.
just more disadvantaged and all of that. That like this shift in structure has like just allowed the space for these people to then, as you say, provide a breath of fresh air. And then, but it's kind of just a natural process then that that's the logical consequence of how the last few years and decades
Yeah,
developed,
yeah,
essentially.
yeah. And I think the major issue is that rather than engaging people like Jordan Peterson or the Tate brothers or Nick Fuentes, instead of like engaging them in debate, these
Yeah,
people
people
are
just follow
labeled.
them blindly then.
Yeah, these people are labeled in a certain way that does not allow for debate. So I'm a big proponent of free speech. I'm a big proponent of free debate. So if you disagree with someone, it's important to engage that person in a debate and show the problems or vulnerabilities in that person's argument. And but when you actually just cancel other people, then that makes them martyrs, and that makes people even more loyal to them.
Right. Okay, thank you for
Okay,
now.
thank
Maybe I have
you.
some questions later.
Okay, yeah. So Pedrin, sorry,
Yes.
yes, hi.
Hello, Professor. Thank you so much for your time. Hello, class. In your most recent post, The Perfect Storm, you had a lot of great correlations. One of the big ones you made was the collapse of the Bronze Age to where we are in history. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that. And then the point that really stuck out to me, because I think many people would sweep it under the rug, is that at Anchorage, at the most recent NATO conference, Trump gave the green light to Zelensky for producing the Patriot Defense Missile System in-house in Ukraine. What does that mean? How will Putin escalate?
Right, okay. So I draw a correlation between our time and the Bronze Age collapse because both times are represent a time of maximum globalization, meaning that Pax Americana, the American Empire, is able to co cover every aspect of the globe. And so if there's a collapse, it has to be a complete systems collapse, right? So in World War II, Europe did collapse, Asia did collapse, but North America really wasn't that affected. And so North America, primarily the United States, would come over and rebuild the rest of the world. And this is what's led to Pax Americana, okay? Unfortunately, today, Pax America covers every part of the world. So if Pax Americana falls, the American Empire declines, the rest, every part of the world is affected. And this is most noticeable with the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, whereas if this Strait of Hormuz stays closed for the next few weeks, then you'll have famine in Africa, you'll have lockdowns in East Asia, you'll have inflation in America. the global south won't be able to feed the population in about a year's time. So we can see how one part of the world can cascade and affect every other part of the world. Okay, so that's a correlation between the Bronze Age and our world today. And then the idea of Trump telling Zelensky, like, now he can manufacture Patriot air defense systems. Okay, so this is a major escalation, and it shows us that this conflict between Trump and NATO, it was just theater. It was never really a conflict. The Americans were always in control of NATO. And so this is something that I've talked about before, but if you look at the national defense strategy that the Pentagon or the State Department of War has published, it calls for a three-pillar strategy, okay? The first pillar is something called the Donald Rock Doctrine, which is America will maintain control and hegemony throughout the Western Hemisphere. Basically, it will remove Russia and China from the Western Hemisphere and force China, especially China, to pay a heavy premium if it wants to trade with, say, Brazil or Argentina or Chile, okay? And China has no choice but to trade with the Western Hemisphere because China relies on the world for its food and energy needs. Okay, so that's pillar number one, the Donroe Doctrine. Pillar number two is for America to use its naval supremacy and air supremacy to control the world's major maritime choke points, which includes the Strait of Malacca, the Strait of Gibraltar, the Panama Canal, the Arctic Circle, the Cape of Good Hope, and also the Strait of Hormuz. So even though it seems as though the Iranians have control the Strait of Hormuz, ultimately, it's Americans who can control who leaves and enters the Strait of Hormuz, okay? So the second pillar is for the Americans to control all the world's major maritime choke points in order to control trade. And the third pillar of the strategy is to create conflicts in the three major spheres of influence in the world, okay? So basically, what America wants is a conflict between NATO and Ukraine, NATO and Russia in Ukraine, a conflict between Japan and China over Taiwan, a conflict between Iran and Israel over the Middle East, okay? And with these conflicts, America doesn't need to win any of them. All America needs is for these wars to be continuous, to keep on going, and that way America can supply all three regions with resources, primarily energy and food, armaments, weapons, and also financing, right? And this will resolve the issue of the $40 trillion of U.S. national debt, because what America will do is offload its debt to the rest of the world. And so that's really the strategy of America moving forward. And we're seeing this play out now in Ukraine, where now America is going to subsidize Ukrainian manufacturer of weapons. So when Trump says to Zelensky, you're now able to manufacture Patriot missiles, he's not saying that Ukraine will do so. What he's saying is that Europe will do so. That's a huge difference, right? Because if these weapons are being manufactured in Ukraine, it's fairly easy for Russia to target these factories and destroy these factories. But if these factories are located inside Germany, Latvia, Romania, Poland, these places, if Russia were to attack these factories, that would invoke Article 5 of NATO, which would basically lead us to nuclear Armageddon. And I don't think Russia wants to cross that line. I don't think Russia wants to escalate to that point. Okay, so that's what's happening. So when Trump says he is giving Ukraine Patriot missiles, what he's really saying is that he's arming Europe for a long-term confrontation with Russia. So, and then Russia knows this, and what we're seeing from Russia is they're moving towards total war. So right now it's a special military operation, but now you have a lot of top Russian officials saying, look, this is a war against NATO. So let's stop pretending and let's move towards total war. Okay, so that's the situation with Ukraine.
Thank you so much.
Okay, great. All right, Nicholas?
Hello, Professor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You sound great.
Okay, thank you very much. Hi, everybody. So also taking into consideration what you just spoke about the current state of the world. Well, I live in Colombia. Okay. I was born in Peru. So I always think that this kind of pressure in the other side of the world, especially with Iran and with the food production over there, is going to create more instability in this part of the world, in Latin America. So I'm not sure if you have any predictions or any thoughts about how that's going to play out in our part of the world.
Yeah, so unfortunately, America will become very aggressive in the Northern Hemisphere. So we saw what America did to Venezuela in January of this year. Right now, what America is doing is embargoing Cuba. So these millions of Cubans are not have lost access to energy, okay? So Cuba is not able to produce its own energy. It has to import it from Venezuela. And now Russia is trying to supply Cuba with energy and with food, but that's not a long-term solution. So we can expect Cuba to be the next domino to fall. And Trump also has ambitions for Greenland and for Alberta as well in Canada. So Trump, he speaks his mind. I mean, that's a thing that's very confusing about Trump, in that Trump is really the only politician in the world who actually speaks what he thinks. I mean, he changes his mind all the time, but he's going to tell you exactly how he thinks. And so he wants Mexico. So they will use a pretext of funding the cartels to eventually subvert Mexico and force Mexico into becoming a vassal state. They will also go after Colombia as well, using the same pretext of fighting the cartels, trying to stop the drug trade, trying to stop fentanyl from crossing the American border. And what this is going to lead to is a major surge of Latin American nationalism. And so, Latin Americans are really disgusted by what happened in Venezuela. They're really disgusted by what they're seeing in Cuba. And unfortunately, the Americans will only become more aggressive over time. And the reason why is their economy is suffering, the global economy is suffering. So what they need to do is cannibalize the Western Hemisphere. They basically need to go in and steal resources from the Western Hemisphere. And at first, it will seem the Americans are very successful, but eventually you will have many indigenous movements rise up and fight against America. There's a very good reason why America didn't do this in the past, right? America could always choose, if it wanted to colonize the entire Western Hemisphere. It didn't do so because it was a pain in the ass. Because you didn't want to deal with nationalists. You didn't want to deal with guerrilla warfare. So that's a situation that the Western Hemisphere is heading towards. I will also point out Argentina is a flashpoint. So I wrote about Argentina a few weeks ago. And one of my readers made a very interesting comment, which is, you know what? They'll probably fix the World Cup for Argentina to make Argentina's more submissive to Pax Judaica and to the Americans. And that's exactly what's happening right now. If you just watch the World Cup, it's clear they are fixing the stupid thing, okay, for Messi. And you know what? I wouldn't be surprised in 5 years' time, Messi is elected the president of Argentina for life, okay? I would not be surprised if in 5 years' time they make Messi king of Argentina. And of course, he will serve the Zionist and American imperial interests. So, yeah.
All right, Professor. Professor, if you don't mind, I have a second question.
Sure, go ahead.
Unrelated. It has to do with what someone else put on the chat. It's regarding, for example, since I watch your classes, I have access to different books that maybe I have not come before. I basically had to build my own curriculum so I can study on my own. But sometimes it feels overwhelming. And I'm not sure if you have any kind of way or any advice for us that some, for example, I feel like I've been left behind by the education system. I'm trying to catch up right now, but it feels hard while trying to play the adult in the society. So do you have any words or advice regarding that?
Yeah, so I would suggest that it's very important to read good books, because reading good books really enhances your own capacity to think deeply and to really study the news, right? So we're bombarded by news all the time. The problem for us is, how do you differentiate what is real news from what is fake news, right? So I spend all my time on Twitter, and I need to figure out what is real and what is fake, because 90% of what you read on Twitter is going to be fake news, right? And so I think reading really good books really trains the mind to do so. So the first book I would recommend is maybe the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. It's a great book, really fun to read, and there are lots of YouTube videos that that explain it. And Thucydides is, I think, the greatest geopolitical strategist ever in human history. So I strongly recommend Thucydides. And you know, the great thing is that what's happening in the world today is very similar to what happened between Athens and Sparta, like, you know, over 2,000 years ago. So it's really relevant. And the thing about the Greeks is they're very objective. You know, like Thucydides, even though he was an Athenian general, he was trying to write about the war from a very objective lens. So that's the first book I would recommend.
Okay, so basically reading good books to discriminate truth from fake.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, reading good books will really enhance your critical thinking skills.
Thank you so much.
Great. Okay. Joyce?
Hello, Professor Zhang. My name is Joyce. I live in the New York City area. So I actually have three questions. If it's too much,
No worries.
You don't have to answer all of them or pick the one you like.
We have lots of time, yep.
Okay, so in no particular order, what signals do you look for? Like, I understand, I've asked you like about timing before, and you say like you don't like to talk about timing because it's impossible to know like when things will play out, right? Okay, that's fine. So then I guess, what are like signals that you will look for actively as kind of a like a sign that things are going to change dramatically one way or another?
Yeah, so when I follow the news, I'm always looking for anomalies, okay? Or the idea of cognitive dissonance, which is given my understanding of something, this should not be happening. And so the best example of cognitive dissonance is when the FBI, they raided Trump's Mar-a-Lago mansion back in, I believe, was it 2021? March of 2021. But I knew that when the FBI did that, that Trump would become president in 2024. And the reason why is that with the FBI weaponized against Trump, Trump would have no choice but to reclaim the presidency to defend himself. Also, the FBI, by doing that, made Trump into a folk hero, right? Because the American people are disgusted with the political elite. And Trump, in the 4 years he was in office, really didn't really do much for American people. And that's probably why he lost his election, his re-election campaign. But when the FBI invaded, when the FBI raided Trump's house, the people felt that Trump is now the underdog. And it's possible that Trump, if he goes back into office, he would basically make everyone piss their pants, you know, really shake things up. And so I was convinced after that event that Trump would win in 2024. And that's number one. Number two is when in January 2020, when the Americans killed General Qassem Soleimani. And the reason why is the General Soleimani was the Middle East envoy for the Iranians. And for the past 20 years, he was working with the Americans on the war on terror. So the Iranians were huge supporters of the Americans in their fight against ISIS in Iraq, because the Iranians did not want these, you know, these Sunni extremists near their border. So for these past 20 years, the Americans and General Soleimani were getting along really well, and then they killed him. So that basically told me the Americans were intent on declaring war against Iran. So those are two things that I thought were not anomalies, and they didn't really accord with how things worked, and that just tells you that there's a sea shift in place, that something is afoot. So the assassination of General Soleimani convinced me that the Americans would invade Iran really, really quickly. And they would have done so if Trump had won his re-election campaign in 2020. And then when Trump got raided by the FBI, I was convinced that Trump would win the 2024 election.
Interesting. Thank you. So my second question is, it seems to me you read primarily English news. So I'm curious, if you read or can read news in other languages. And so what do you read and kind of what are the disparities that you see between different languages?
That's a great question. I wished I read widely, but I don't read widely. I stick primarily to English news sources just because it's just easier for me to access. I tend to read really quickly. I can read Chinese, but I read it very slowly. Now, I do keep I do keep apprised of Chinese news. And my wife just tells me what the headlines are every single day. I'm interested in Chinese news because I find actually Chinese news to be actually pretty objective when it comes to foreign events. China doesn't seem that invested in the world, and so its news media tends to be pretty objective when it reports. And I'll pay attention to some Russian and Iranian news as well, right? So when an event happens, I'm trying to get information from all sources. So the Americans will say something. Maybe the BBC or New York Times say something about Iran, in which case I would want to know what the Iranian state media would say about the same thing. And where they converge, I know it to be objective. But I mean, like, it's a great point where, if you really want to keep informed about the world, you want to have as many different news sources as possible in different languages. And nowadays with social media, it is possible to auto-translate a lot of news items.
So I don't know if you've seen like the thing called Press Reader. They have it in hotels from time to
Right.
time, and it kind of collates a lot of different newspapers from everywhere.
Right.
Okay, so I have my last question is, so I have kids as well. I have two young daughters. So I'm curious, for the purpose of helping them, not be stuck in a box, right, in whatever education system they're in, to develop them as critical thinkers. Are there programs that you know of that are good for that, that aren't necessarily in any particular physical location, and or is that something you're developing yourself?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you know the Waldorf school system, the Waldorf school system developed by Rudolf Steiner. That's something to look at. The Silicon Valley executives in California, they send all their kids to Rudolf these Waldorf schools because these Waldorf schools emphasize a lot of natural play, just like kids run around in the forest a lot. And that's really important for kids. And Silicon Valley executives do this because they know that technology is designed to be as addictive as possible. So if kids at a very early age start looking at the screen too much, their minds are captured. The screens are set up in a certain way that it becomes almost addictive, right? It's always causing this dopamine release inside the brain. And so you want your kids away from sugar. You want your kids away from the screen as much as possible. I have three kids, and I struggle with this because these things are so pervasive throughout society, right? And these things are designed to be addictive. So the quickest way to solve a problem is, hey, if the kid is naughty, hey, here's a candy. Shut up, man. Or hey, here's an iPad. Go away for half an hour. So it's very convenient. These things, but they're really, really bad for children. So my best advice is to really limit as much as possible both sugar access as well as screen access.
Thank you.
Great. And you had a third question?
Oh no, that was my third
Oh, sorry,
question.
sorry, sorry. I lost. Okay. Hey,
Yeah.
thanks a lot. Okay. Nick? Hi, Nick.
Hi, Professor. Hi. This is Nick from Beijing. Thank you for hosting this meeting. I really appreciate this opportunity. I basically have two questions on self-exploration and then the other one on educating young children. I believe Joyce's question is actually quite similar to mine. So let me first set up my perspective. So when watching through, yeah, thank you. When watching through your lectures, I feel enlightened many times, and I would like to think that my inner spark shines when I got my own ideas inspired in this process. So from these experiences, I also recollected that when during the process of me growing up in China, I actually have had some of these similar moments where I can simply relate to the idea and believe it to be true, even without logic reasoning. And in many of these cases, however, those insights I had are opposite to the common sense I was taught in China education system or by my parents. Therefore, most of them are actually discouraged. And I was taught the priority is to get good marks and good scores and a good job. So these conflicts have always been in my mind, even until like a couple of years ago, in my 30s, basically. And in the system is finally clear through learning your view of the world and reflecting it into my daily life. So, and then, however, from this enlightenment, I have a new doubt, which originated from a Marxist theory I once firmly believed to be to make sense. So basically, the base and the superstructure theory, the material base is kind of dominant when shaping the superstructure. So my oversimplification is basically that. My doubt is based on this, is that if the base and superstructure theory is true and also can relate to personal on personal level, then is it possible that my enlightenment is based on the materialist education I received, which granted me my current economic status, which I would say is comfortable in China.
Sure.
Then I would have the free bandwidth and also the sort of the vision, the open vision to access more knowledge and seek insights. So I'm curious, my first question is, I'm curious how your view is on this base and superstructure theory, and does my doubt make sense? And then directly related, I have a four-year-old son. I want him to have the same insights that I had when he grows up and seek his own path of enlightenment. But then it's a really the classic question for China family. How should I balance this education versus his material base or aiming for the good marks? And then the education for his imagination and exploration. It might be sound stupid for me to be anxious about this, but I'm the father. As a father, I'm genuinely concerned. I also have read your book.
Oh,
Try to look. Look, it's a really great book.
thank you.
Like I spent like one afternoon and reading it. I just cannot stop. But really want to have this discussion with you on these topics directly. As you see, they're kind of related.
Yeah, so
Thank you.
thank you so much. And I really sympathize with your plight because I'm also Chinese, and we grew up in a culture that is extremely materialistic. So I was not schooled in China, but I was schooled in Toronto, and my parents were Chinese, and so I've always developed a very materialistic worldview, and we were not at all religious. And for the longest time, I was a firm believer in Marxist theory, especially the idea of base and superstructure, and I really believe the world was materialistic. But as time progresses, I recognize that materialism is a dead end. If you really believe that the world is just materialistic and there's no spiritual aspect to the world, there's no God, I think that's a source of your fear and anxiety, right? Because if you just take that as a premise, then you're just stuck forcing your kid try to do as well in school as possible. You're stuck trying to get your kid into the best school, the best university, the best job. And it's a dead end. So I think that you have to really question this materialist perspective. And these past 4 years, from my intense study of Dante, the great books, Homer, Plato, from my own analysis and research in the occult, I'm convinced now that the materialist worldview is just wrong. It makes absolutely no sense, and it's a dead end. And so I've adopted a much more spiritual, religious worldview, and this it's very similar to Hinduism, Buddhism, Hermeticism, Gnosticism. I think all the great religious traditions align in the belief that the universe is conscious and that our consciousness is what makes us human. And our consciousness is connected infinitely to the universe across infinite dimensions. And I plan to do a series on their cult very soon, hopefully as soon as September or October. But I really want to enlighten the world and teach the idea that the universe is conscious and that we are all spiritual beings at the end of the day. And once you recognize that, then the answers unfold before you. And once you're committed to living a spiritual life, then you'll figure out how to raise children to the best of your ability. So I have three young kids, and the eldest is 8, the middle is 4, the youngest is 3. And I struggle with the same issues that you struggle with, Nick. And what I recognize is that as long as you make the commitment to love your child and respect your child's individuality, then the child will be fine. And your child doesn't really need to go to the best university. Your child doesn't need to be a millionaire. Your child will be a very, very happy person. So, love, it's really about trusting the other person, right? So I understand there's a lot of pressure to make sure your child does well. But if you find the strength to just trust your child and let your child and let and like communicate more of your child, then your child is going to do really well. I mean, I work in education. I for the past 20, 30 years in China, I've written 2 books about Chinese education. And in my experience, the kids who do the best are those with parents who are loving, who give them a lot of space, who respect the choices, who are like friends to them. And the kids who don't do really well are kids with who are like tiger moms, right? Who pressure the kids to succeed every single day. So I think, if you love your child, you would trust your child and respect his or her opinions. But if you want your child to do really well in life, you would also just trust your child and respect his or her opinions. Okay?
Gotcha. That makes sense.
All right.
Maybe a very quick follow-up.
Sure.
You talk about religious and spiritual learning. And what is the right time or right avenue for introducing those ideas to children? Especially I grew up, I grew up in China, so I don't have those experience. So I just I'm kind of lost on this.
I think children are intuitively religious people. So there's really, you should start right away. We have great conversations at home about religion. My eldest son, who's 8 years old, he's convinced that he's from another planet. Okay. His soul transmigrated to our world. So they have an intuitive understanding of these things. So, introduce your child to Buddhism, to Taoism, to different aspects of religion. And that I think is really going to motivate your child to do better in school. I'm a good friend in Beijing, and she has 3 kids, and they're a Catholic family, and her kids are wonderful. So I think having that sort of like religious community is really, really helpful in raising a child.
Gotcha. Really appreciate the
Yeah, no,
discussion.
no.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nick. Okay. Fred?
Hey, Zhang. Hello, founding members. I'm Fred coming here from Kentucky. And the question I kind of have for you has to go back kind of with the war situation currently. I'm interested, and I guess Joyce started to point it out with some of the viable signals that you use and see in order to help make some predictions or assumptions on what's happening next. And I was wondering if you could go over some of the possible attack and movement vectors of some of the proxy groups for the IRGC. I know you briefly touched upon a potential strategic attack on like maybe the three ports or the Port of Haifa in particular for Israel. And that kind of piqued my interest as something I hadn't thought about. And I wanted to see if there's any other strategic movements there that you could go over as far as the proxy groups. I don't think
Sure.
it's covered too much in the news.
Yeah, so if I'm Israel, okay, if I'm the United States, the proxies are a huge problem because if I launch my ground invasion, my flank is still vulnerable because of these proxies, right? The Houthis, the Shia militias in Iraq, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, okay? So I need to neutralize all three before I can launch my
True.
ground invasion, okay? So the signals are this, okay? Lebanon is the major point of contention, right? So if you look at the MOU, it's extremely generous to the Iranians, right? It's like it promises $300 billion in investment after the war ends. It promises to lift sanctions. It promises to unfreeze assets, and I think the assets total about $1 trillion. Okay, there are a lot of Iranian assets that have been frozen by the Americans and their allies. Okay, so it's very favorable to the Iranians. The point of contention is Hezbollah, right? So the Iranians demand that whatever peace conditions that the Iranians and the Americans agreed to will apply immediately to Hezbollah. And the Americans say yes, but Israel is not respecting this clause, right? So I think that the MOU is structured in a way to create a wedge issue between Iran and Hezbollah, right? The Iranian people are like, why do we care about Hezbollah? And Hezbollah has always been a source of tension and conflict throughout the Middle East. So if the Hezbollah were eliminated, wouldn't this mean more peace in the Middle East? Sorry?
被特斯拉关闭是吧？
Okay. All right. Okay. So Hezbollah is a point of contention. We're also seeing that Trump is now being very nice to Syria. Al-Jolani participated in the NATO summit in Ankara, and America is going to lift all sanctions on Syria. And I think the idea is to bring in Syria into the war against Lebanon, right? So what's going to happen is this. Trump is going to try to create a wedge issue in Iran, where the political leadership just wants to abandon Hezbollah. Trump wants to create a civil war in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is fighting the government of Lebanon, and then the Syrians will attack from the north, and the Israelis will attack from the south. And I think that given all this dynamic, it's going to be very hard for Hezbollah to survive. I think like there are a lot of players in the Middle East who are committed to eradicating Hezbollah because they've always been a huge problem in the Middle East. And so I think that's the Lebanon issue. Okay, so watch for what Syria does. I think Syria will start to send in forces from the north. Watch what the Lebanese government does. Lebanese government may decide to take up arms against Hezbollah. Watch the rhetoric coming from Iran, where the Iranian political leadership may start to criticize Hezbollah more. Okay, so that's Lebanon. Now we move to Iraq, and what's really important in Iraq is that maybe a week ago there was almost like a coup in Iraq where the prime minister launched a corruption crackdown on major political figures in Baghdad. And a lot of people suspect that what he's doing is he's trying to clean house, basically eliminate the Shia militias, and then use Iraq as a springboard for an American invasion, basically arm the Kurds and have them cross the border into northwestern Iran. So that's Iraq. And the third point are the Houthis. And what Saudi Arabia is doing is they're arming the local tribes people in Yemen against the Houthis, right? So there are lots of different ethnic groups in Yemen, and the Houthis are just one of them. And so basically, Saudi Arabia wants to finance a civil war in Yemen. And they've been financing a civil war in Yemen for the past decade anyway. Okay, so with these three movements, you are now trying to neutralize and isolate each of these proxy groups, so they can no longer coordinate. And then once these groups have been neutralized, then you launch a ground invasion against Iran. And during this process, I hate to say this, but there's very little Iran can actually do about it, right? Because before, the way that Iran supplied Hezbollah was through the land bridge for Syria. But now Syria is now controlled by the Israelis and the Americans. The Houthis are too far away. The Shia militias are too weak. So it's a very dire situation right now for the Iranian proxies. So does that make sense, Fred? Do you have any follow-up questions?
Absolutely. No, that basically seems like the only option they have, like, is to really maintain control of the strait in order to get enough money in order to fund those proxies to kind of get them in the best position. My second question I did have for you was, it's actually very similar to Nick, on if you had any recommendation based on what you've been able to selectively attend to with different great books. If someone was going to go about reading about Zoroastrianism or the Kabbalah, do you have a recommendation on where they should start with that?
Yeah. So again, I plan to do an occult series in a month or two. I'm doing a lot of research right now. But, you know, it's very hard to do the Kabbalah, to do the occult by yourself. It really is. You really need to be taught the basic principles and to work with a group, right? To just learn by yourself, it will just confuse you, especially the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah is one of the craziest things you will ever learn. And they say a lot of these Kabbalists, they have schizophrenia. I mean, like if you actually just study the Kabbalah and you try to make sense of it, it'll drive you insane. So, you know, I'm gonna do a cult series, and I'll, and you know, like we'll do these monthly live streams. And so, please follow the occult series, and I'll give a lot of recommendations. And then we can discuss a lot of these ideas during the live stream. If you want to get started, the best book I would recommend is Manly P. Hall. I'll write for you. Okay, Manly P. Hall. And it's all free online, okay? Manly P. Hall, he's probably one of the best writers on the occult, and so I would suggest reading him to start.
Awesome, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Fred. Okay, Dominique.
Yes, hello, Professor. Before I start, could you write down for us also a reference to the other book that you recommended?
Yeah, sure. It's called The Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. Yeah, and again, all these books are free online or at the library.
Thank you. I have quite a few questions, and I would like to start by having basically a discussion with the current situation in Europe, because we have a huge problem with immigration and a very big lack or decrease of cohesion between the nation itself and the population within the nations. And I'm in Switzerland, so it's not as disastrous, let's say, as in the European Union, but just last at the start of the month, for example, a new law was passed, and now the Supreme, let's call it court, but it's not really a Supreme Court. It's the law, basically the Supreme Law System in Switzerland now has to respond to the European Union, to Brussels. But it was masqueraded underneath as the top to 10 million people. But in order to do that, then this was a consequence. So, and we see this basically in an exponential trend throughout Europe. How much hope do we have in the coming years because I believe this is kind of a natural phase in which we have to go through. It's unfortunate we are in the middle of it, but it's inevitable. Even those who oppose this trend are opposing a natural phase of history, I believe. But based on past patterns, how do you see it going forward?
Yeah, so the trend in Europe is not very good. And a lot of the issue is that you have this aloof bureaucracy in Brussels, and they live in their own bubble, right? It's like Washington, D.C. in America, where they really don't care what the local people think. All they care is, you know, what their friends and their colleagues think, and they're a bubble, okay? And these people in Brussels are committed to total war against Russia. They see Russia as the greatest threat to Western civilization. They believe that Russia will be defeated in Ukraine. And once Russia is defeated in Ukraine, then peace and prosperity will come to Europe. Okay, this is like literally how they think. They think that Ukraine is only a day away from winning this war. They think that Vladimir Putin is only a day away from being overthrown by his own military. They think that Russia, the entire economy, is only a day away from collapse, right? And once this war in Ukraine is won, then Europe will be able to exploit Ukrainian resources, as well as force Russia to pay reparations for the war. In which case, you have like $10 trillion. In which case, you've solved all the problems of Europe, right? Now you're able to finance the pension system. Now you're able to provide social welfare to a lot of people. So as long as the Europeans are willing to make these sacrifices, then Europe will win this war and save Western civilization. This is literally how they think, okay? And it's eschatological, it's visionary, and it's delusional. And so they believe that all sacrifices are necessary and justify to defeat Russia, okay? And so unfortunately, what this means is that Europe is slowly moving towards total war, basically mobilization for war. This means conscription, right? Where young men are now conscripted to fight this war in Ukraine. This means diverting all financing to weapons production, to continue this war in Ukraine, to basically creating as much debt as possible in order to make sure Ukraine stays afloat. And basically stir up as much anti-Russia hatred as possible, okay? So this is my prediction of where Europe is heading. And this is usually what societies in decline do, right? So, you know, in the chat, there's a really good conversation where Leandro asks, why doesn't America just pack up and leave the Middle East? And the answer is, that's not how the world works. This is not how empires behave. Empires are empires because they're able to exploit and suppress the people who are weaker than they are and extract value from this exploitation, right? So if America were to the next day say, you know, screw this, we're leaving the Middle East, the American empire would collapse, right? Because now the GCC has to pay reparations to Iran. Iran now controls the Strait of Hormuz. Iran, Russia, and China can create their own trade bloc. And so America would collapse financially, and America would declare insolvency because it has $40 trillion in debt. The American people will rise up and it'll be a revolution in America. So the imperial elite in America has absolutely no choice but to continue to fight this war. Same thing in Europe, where the bureaucratic elite in Brussels has absolutely no choice but to continue to fight this war in Ukraine. And they honestly believe that this war will be won next month or next year at the latest, but this war will be won. Do you have any follow-up questions, Dominique?
Because do you see it as an option? I think this was from one of your lectures on YouTube when you were teaching. And you said that when you want to send troops, one of the first, when there is no support from the population for a war, then one of the things that you can do is send immigrants or those who are unwelcome. So do you see that as an option in Europe as well when all of this is going to play out?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? So a lot of these immigrants are military age men. The problem is that it's very hard to get these men to go to war. These men are not going to fight for you. They might run away. So the problem is that these bureaucrats in Europe, they will often take the path of least resistance, okay? Meaning it is easier for them to get their native population to go fight this war than it is to get the immigrant population to go fight this war. And so it's not a conspiracy. I mean, a lot of people think, okay, isn't this population replacement where you have these millions of Muslim immigrants in the country? And if Germany, if Romania, if Poland send their native people to go fight in Ukraine and they all die, then you have population replacement because these Muslim men just take over, right? And it's a nice conspiracy theory, but the people in charge are not that smart and don't think that long term. They always pick the path of least resistance. And for them, it's always like, what is the most politically expedient thing to do in the short term? And again, they're not planning for total war. They're not planning to send young men to die in Ukraine. They literally believe that the war will be over next month. And as long as Europe stays united, as long as Europe stays committed to the fight, this war will be over next month, okay? So what's going to happen is a sunk cost fallacy where right now they're sending in weaponry, financing to Ukraine, okay? And this war has not been won. So now you spend in special forces. Then you send in mercenaries. Then you start sending in volunteer forces. Then you start to conscript young men, okay? This is World War I all over again. And so, again, it's not long-term thinking, okay? Because these people are incapable of long-term thinking. It's just like a short-term, politically expedient solution to a problem that they're in. And unfortunately, all that's going to happen is they're going to keep on digging a bigger hole, okay? Sarah says, they just made a budget for the next 8 years. We pay automatic taxes that go to Ukraine. Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? So they're digging this hole where they think that we don't have to send in men to die in Ukraine. We just have to send in financing. But eventually, you're going to have to reach a point where you're forced to send forces, troops into Ukraine. It's sunk cost fallacy. It's like going to a casino where you didn't expect to be $10 million in debt. But once you're $10 million in debt, you're stuck there for the rest of your life, gambling to pay it off, right? And that's what's going to happen in Ukraine. Does it make sense, Ukraine? Any follow-up questions?
Yeah, I just, as you were speaking, I also thought, well, but there is also the fact that as the lifestyle keeps become in Europe is always harder and harder and harder in exponentially, there is going to be like a point, a triggering point in which people will not be able to take it anymore. And we're going to have to see some violence in the streets.
Yeah.
So sending away young men to play and fight your war for you is also a prevention from this from happening.
Exactly. You're exactly right. So again, they're not planning for this, but when they're forced a choice between, you know, sending the man to die in a war or having them, burn down your streets, like go rioting, well, we'll send the men off to die in Ukraine. And unfortunately, okay, the native population is going to be a lot less obedient than the immigrant population, okay? So the immigrants are going to stay at home and not riot. The native people are going to riot. And so you send the native people to go die in war, not the immigrant population to go die in war. So it's very strange. Like, everyone knows what's going to happen. But again, the bureaucrats in Brussels, they're in a bubble, and they're stuck in a sunk cost fallacy, and they're just going to dig a bigger hole for themselves. And when you send young men to die in a war, eventually you're going to have mutinies. Eventually you're going to have civil war back in Europe. So I think this is how it ends. It ends with political revolution in Europe.
And then do we have, because you also said a war is made to destroy money.
Yes.
So if we are going to basically escalate this war so much, alongside all the other wars that are going to be around, basically when it's going to be over, let's say metaphorically speaking, the money is going to be destroyed, AI system is going to be in place, the surveillance state. So there is no reason for people to revolt anymore. So it's like it has to go faster and faster and faster.
Yeah, I think this ends when the world is exhausted, okay? So wars end when a certain faction of the men in your society have died off. So in World War I, I think it was like maybe 10% of the German population, the male population, were killed. And then the Germans could no longer sustain the war, and so they had to sue for peace. So I think this war ends when there's political revolution in Europe, when these parties, right-wing parties, such as AfD in Germany, Marine Le Pen's party in France, when they're able to assume power. But they can only assume power when there's a political revolution, because the bureaucrats in Brussels, they'll just cheat, they'll steal elections, they will do a lot to suppress these parties.
Yes. Just one last, the very last thing, don't want to take too much time, is about the re-election of Trump.
Yes.
You said that Trump is gonna try to make a third term.
Yes.
And potentially as a vice president. Now, the objection is, well, the Constitution says that you cannot be elected. And you said, well, it doesn't say specifically, because it says exactly it cannot be elected, but it's not an election for the vice president.
Right.
But okay. As we know, they, as you said in an interview, they are part of the whole package. Like, now we have Trump, Vance. So if they're part of the whole package, the vice president is elected alongside the president, meaning he cannot run alongside the president because it would be part of the election.
Okay.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, okay. So I did some research, okay? And my analysis before was wrong, okay? I said that the vice president was not elected, and so that's technicality. That's wrong, okay? The Constitution, there's something called the 22nd Amendment. The 22nd Amendment is explicit and says that no one can be president for more than two terms, okay? That's what the 22nd Amendment says. Then I believe there's something called the 12th Amendment. I could be wrong, okay? Let me just really quickly Google this. The 12th Amendment basically said that whatever conditions apply to the presidents, right? Whatever qualifications you need to be president also applies to the vice president. So it says in the Constitution that you have to be born in the United States to be president. Well, if you're vice president, that also applies to you, okay? Now, so theoretically, the 22nd Amendment and 12th Amendment together means that Trump cannot run as vice president. Okay, that's what it should mean. But the difference between the spirit of the Constitution and the letter of the Constitution, right? So if I'm a Supreme Court justice, what I could say is, well, the 12th Amendment meant, what it means is you have to satisfy the conditions of being president in order to be vice president, which means you have to be more than 35 years old, which means you have to be born in the United States. And that's it, okay? And no criminal offense, of course. So these two things are separate, okay? So what I'm saying is, it's not explicit that Trump cannot run as vice president. It's ultimately up to the Supreme Court to decide what the relationship between the 12th Amendment and the 22nd Amendment is. And unfortunately, what we know is that, first of all, the Supreme Court is heavily conservative. I think it's a 6-3 majority for the conservatives. And Trump appointed three of the justices. And it's very possible within a year or two, he will also appoint a fourth. Okay? So I think that if this were to go to Supreme Court, then Trump would win. And he'll be allowed to run as the vice president. But he has also other possibilities as well, where he declares war, and then he can suspend the Constitution, right? In which case, he's dictator for life now. So there are lots of possibilities. But I'm pretty convinced that he will get a third term. Okay? We're good.
Thank you.
All right. Janice?
Hi, Janice Darmody in the States, Midwest. And what I wanted to know is what's one question you wish students would ask more, but almost never do?
Yeah, so I think that it's really important to hear the counter argument, right? So I made this argument. What's the counter argument, right? What would someone else say? And what's a counterpoint? I think it's very important to have that debate. And, you know, honestly, it's good for me because it makes me think a lot deeper. But students don't really do that. So, yeah. Does that make sense, Janice? Did you have a follow-up question?
No, I didn't have a follow-up question. But did you say did you say counter, or I didn't
the counterpoint.
Understand that
the counterpoint. Okay. yeah
okay
right
okay thank you
okay thanks Katria
hi Professor Chong. I have a question.
Sorry, can you turn on your mic, please?
Yeah. Yeah. Hi, yeah. I have a question about magic. You said that you will teach magic. Yeah?
Yes.
Is that on applying?
Yes. Yes.
So if you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
You said you don't know who you want to choose to teach. So if there is a standard, what is it?
I'm sorry. But could you... repeat the question. I didn't catch the question.
You said that you will teach magic. Is that true? Is that on your plane?
Yes. Yes.
So that's the question.
Yeah. So I do plan to teach magic as part of the occult. And so I've been looking at, you know, Aleister Crowley. I've been looking at witchcraft. And to me, it's very interesting what magic is. I think magic is an appreciation that we are all conscious beings. And the question is, how do you focus our conscious energy in a way that allows you to obtain a goal? And so the idea is, that's what magic is, right? Magic is a mechanism for you to completely focus yourself on a goal that allows you to achieve it. But also, magic is a way to convince others that you will achieve it and you deserve it. And so it allows you to manifest your dream a lot easier. So that's what I think magic is. Magic is to convince yourself that the goal is worthy, and to convince you that you must focus all your mental energies on achieving the goal, and to convince the people around you that the goal can be achieved, right? So ritual magic. So that's the main idea of magic, and so I'm teaching it as part of their cult. Okay, so does that make sense?
I just want to know, have you ever read a book about magic? So I have read so many, so I just wondering how you will teach that. Is this things about spirits or just the things about Kabbalah? I just want to know more about this.
Sure. So again, I'm just doing research right now, okay? But one book I've read that was very useful is on sex magic. So Aleister Crowley was a major proponent of sex magic. And so if you just go into the techniques of sex magic, right? So what do you do? Well, first of all, you have to train your body to engage in sex in the long term, right? So basically you want to go for hours and hours of penetration, of ecstasy, without actually ejaculating, without actually having an orgasm. And so you have to actually like train yourself for years to do that. It's not that easy to do, right? Where you just go for like 6 hours straight and have fantastic sex, but you don't ejaculate. You're able to control yourself in a certain way. And then what you do is you also have to find a partner that's able to work with you in this ritual. And then before the sex, there's this very elaborate ritual. And what you're trying to do is during the sex, both of you are trying to align your imagination, right? It's like you both have a wish. And during the 6 hour sex marathon, you're all visualizing together this vision, okay? And why Aleister Crowley would recommend this is, first of all, he thinks that there's just potency to sex, right? So you take this sex drive and you turn it into, and the sex drive can motivate you to greater heights, okay? This like the sex can be channeled in a very positive way. That's point one. Point two is like, the universe itself is sexual, right? So if you look at the Kabbalah, it's about sexual reunion, right? So when you are engaging in sex, you are actually tapping into the fundamental structure of the universe. And it's as though you're with God. And so through sex, with enough concentration, so think of it as meditation. With enough concentration, you're able to implant your idea into the very fabric of the universe and let it spread, right? It's like planting seeds. Okay. And then third of all, through sex, it's also an act of interdimensional communication, right? So sex, you're opening a portal into other dimensions, which allows ideas to come into you. Okay. And that's the very idea of sex magic. And so the way I'll teach this is to examine the different theories, and then explain the mechanisms and explain how different writers describe what's happening. Yeah.
It's more like sex magic. It's more like the mysteries of Isis.
Yes.
Yes. What you said, let me think the book.
Yes.
I will recommend that, The Secret Sex Life of Angels. That book is the things about sex magic you have taught about.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Exactly. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That's all I want to say.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. Ben?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you for taking the time. But yeah, maybe a bit of a broader political question. So what, in your opinion, would be the background factors that people become divided into opposing political groups? So I often notice and get the impression that people simply feel they have to be pro or anti something. So it just seems like the public narratives are framed so that there's only two possible sides, especially, I don't know, if we focus on America, there's like two major parties. So why, in your opinion, does this happen?
Right, okay. So there's been a lot of social scientific research into political polarization, okay? And so there are different factors. So people align with the political party because of their allegiance to the community, right? So if you're born in a certain neighborhood and that neighborhood is Republican or Democratic, you're much more likely to share their political beliefs, okay? So community is one very important factor. Another important factor is the decline in institutions of authority, right? So if people no longer believe in the media, if people no longer believe in the government, if people no longer believe in science, in schools, then they're forced to rely on their tribalism, right? They're forced to rely on the people around them. And that makes them much more anxious to adopt the opinions of the people around them, okay? So the breakdown of institutions of authority, right? Because remember, like, you know, like only 30 years ago, people would watch the news, NBC News, ABC News, and just agree with everything. And NBC News and CBS News, they were meant for national consumption. So they were trying to create a broad national consensus for people. But now no one actually watches mainstream news, except maybe, you know, like these baby boomers. But young people get all their news sources from social media, okay? So that's a breakdown of institutions of authority. The third thing is the rise of social media, where people now are in their own social media bubbles. But the worst thing is how these algorithms are designed, right? So you look at Facebook, if you look at Twitter, they know what they want to do is try to create as much engagement as possible. And they want this engagement to be intense, what they call intensity. And the best way to do that is to provoke strong emotions in people, especially anger, fear, and hatred. And so social media just brings out the worst in people. And because you're in a bubble, these emotions are reinforced. And you know, I mean, so, you know, what gets attention on social media are not this objective analysis of what's going on. What gets attention on social media are just these stupid feuds between influencers, right? These stupid fights that break out between these different influencers, right? So that's a third factor. And the fourth factor is, like, we don't actually spend that much time with other people, okay? We spend too much time online. We are too lonely. And so it's very easy to reinforce our own prejudices about the world. I mean, if we were part of civil society more, if we, like, you know, went bowling with people who are outside our political affiliation, then we'd be much more open-minded. And then, of course, you have the growth of counterculture on both the left and the right, where people are encouraged to just disparage people that you don't agree with, right? So I think there's this amazing statistic where 90% of women will not even date a man from a different political party, right? That's amazing to think about how, like, just you could be the most attractive guy in the world, but if you are a Republican and I'm a Democrat, I'm not going to date you, all right? So there's a lot going on, but this political polarization, it's been going around for a long time. It's gonna be very, very hard to fix. Okay, did you have a follow-up question, Ben, or does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, thank you. I see there are still a lot of other questions, so that's okay. All for now. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Hello, very pleased to greet you all. My name is John Salazar. Thank you, Professor Yang, for sharing so openly your thoughts and your lectures. I'm now going through Dante's Divine Comedy and finding very, very refreshing, very useful all your lectures along Yale University in Beijing in order to understand further Dante's cosmology. I have a question regarding humanity's expansion into space. I watched all your lectures where you've expressed skepticism. I understand part of that maybe as a natural evolution of your own cosmology, as you were alluding to at the start of this call. And I wanted to ask you whether you see the oceans, as a more plausible frontier for human civilization, particularly as there is massive untapped energy resources. For example, over 80% of wind resource, technical wind resource, lies on deeper waters, and that's still to be untapped. We are commencing now to develop that in some countries such as China and some nations in Europe as well.
Right. Thanks so much, John. The idea of green tech or clean tech, right? Green tech, clean tech. Actually, these things aren't that clean, right? So you look at electric vehicles, which China just dominates. these batteries that they use cause a lot of pollution. So I'm in Beijing, and there are several battery recycling facilities around Beijing, and they release so many chemicals into the air. And electricity, it's not, it comes from coal, right? So so these EVs are very, very dirty for the environment. So, and it's same for, you know, these solar panels as well, because they rely a lot on rare earths. And we know it is very, very, it causes a lot of pollution to mine rare earths. And, and that's why China dominates the rare earths market, because China is willing to bear the environmental costs of mining rare earths in a way that other nations are not, right? I mean, basically, because China is so aggressive in mining rare earths in order to feed its green tech or clean tech industry, China is dooming its many generations to basically pollution, right? So a lack of access to clean air, clean water, clean land. So I think green tech, clean tech, these are misnomers. And I think, like, they're not the solution. I think the solution is to create a much more sustainable way of life where people are less focused on consumerism and more focused on spirituality, on being kind to people around them. Right. So, so John, does that make sense? Or did you have a follow-up question?
Well, I would like to add, how about coming from the point of view of scarcity of resources, even if we make society more sustainable, fossil fuels are still a limited resource, and at some point that's coming to an end. So we can still have a more sustainable society that you're alluding to, but relying on, in this case, energy, the sun is over there. The wind is generated as a consequence of the sun, and it's plenty of available resource. So that's the counter argument or the other angle I would put on the table for you to consider.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully this works. Hopefully renewable energy, clean tech, green tech provides a solution. But I'm not that optimistic. I think the world is too dependent on cheap energy. And right now, the best place to access cheap energy is the Middle East. So, I would love to be wrong, but I'm not that optimistic about green tech.
Much appreciated for your thoughts.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks. Sean the Scribe. Sean the Scribe. Hi, Sean.
Hey, it's Shannon, or Shan the Scribe.
Oh, okay. Hey, Shannon, hey.
Hi, no worries. Greetings from San Diego. I had a couple questions about some of your... Okay, well, I had a question about something that's come up in the U.S. recently. So I noticed that one of the things that Trump campaigned upon was, like, student loan stuff and student loan forgiveness, which I was just like, that's not happening, but he's definitely getting elected based on that. And something that I noticed recently is that, so originally, a lot of student loans were in forbearance, but because they canceled some of the repayment plans, they were restarting the payments this year. And I was like, that's kind of weird. So I applied for the forbearance because it was supposed to be in like 2028 was when it was over. But then if you get approved for the forbearance, they only give you until November, which my brain was like, that's kind of interesting, because isn't that when all of these things are supposed to transpire? So I guess my question is, like, one of my questions is, do you think that, like, you know, because of, like, the war and stuff like that, do you think that Trump would maybe use that money for, like, to fund the war or something?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to be cynical, but I think the people in charge, the elite, they're interested in stealing as much money as possible, as quickly as possible. So the idea, like, they're actually going to use any money for maybe a national objective, like win the war in the Middle East, that I think is questionable. I think, you know, so recently Trump has earmarked $1.5 trillion to the Pentagon. And people are like, wow, this means that America is going to remilitarize. No, it doesn't. What it means is a lot of this money is going to go to the swamp, right? It's being siphoned off by these military contractors. And this is a reason why America is losing this war in the Middle East, because America's not that serious about winning the war. What America is serious about, what the American elite wants to do, is steal as much money as possible during the course of this war, right? So, you know, Julian Assange said it best: the point of wars is not to win. The point of wars is just to have wars so that the transnational elite can just steal from the American taxpayer. Hi, Shannon.
Okay, that does make sense to me.
Right.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
That does make sense to me. Something else that you talked about in terms of the Constitution, I had a question about that because the last time I went to the bookstore, they actually had like a little zine of the Constitution. It was like $2. And so I ended up buying it because of some of your lectures. And it does say technically on the 12th Amendment, but no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of the vice president of the United States. But I do think that what you're talking about him getting a third term through like, not like a main way, because he can't technically be the president again. But right. I do think that there's like some sneaky intention to somehow get the third term or get a lot of influence over whoever is going to be the next person. So I just wanted to point that out because I remember seeing that when I opened. It's like it's really small. It just has like all of the rules in there for some reason.
Yeah. So again, I think Trump wants to be president for life. Okay. I think the idea like he just steps back and is a puppet master behind JD Vance, it's not going to work for him. He like if you just look at his entire career, he's never had a protege. He's never really had anyone that he trusts, like basically he just has a habit of like not trusting anyone around him, including his own children, and screwing everyone over. Okay, yeah. So Nicholas says King Trump. Yeah, he wants to be king for life. Okay, and like that right. That's the only way that that's the only way he'll be satisfied. So he's not gonna be a puppet master behind the scenes. He will be president, I think, for a third term. And again, there are many loopholes that he can use to achieve this. And again, I think this is going to go to Supreme Court because Trump is so narcissistic that he wants to be elected to a third term, right? And you know what would be really funny is that in 2028, if Trump actually runs as VP, the Democrats will put up Obama as their VP, right?
I can see that.
Right? It's going to be Obama-Trump in 2028. Great. This will be like the greatest political event in our lives.
The definition of an American politics.
Yeah. Like this, it'll be a complete circus, okay? Obama, Trump. This is something that Trump would actually want because he actually thinks that he could defeat Obama in a general election. I'm pretty confident Trump's getting a third term, and if he does run as vice president, the Democrats will put up Obama as the candidate. Yep.
Right. Okay. Just because it's against the law doesn't mean somebody's going to actually. This doesn't mean he's not going to try. Because it takes a long time for the bureaucracy to catch up with his actions, so he'll still maybe try it.
Yeah, so I would argue it's actually not against the law. It's not explicit in the Constitution that you cannot run as a VP. A lot of laws are just based on social convention. So if you just actually refuse to accept the social convention, you can get away with a lot, okay? So what I tell people is, like, Trump running for a third term, it's crazy, it's dangerous, it's insane, it's wrong, but it's not illegal. So we'll see, but I think it's very likely he'll run for a third term. Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so I watched your Dante series and I really really liked it.
Thank you.
But I had a question about unconditional love. Right. So that's something that was really prominent in the series, but do you have any advice for people who maybe didn't have unconditional love as a child and maybe like if you never experienced it, yeah, you can experience love, but how do you know if you're able to produce unconditional love if you yourself never experienced unconditional love?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So I had a very traumatic childhood and I was convinced no one loved me. And that screwed me up throughout my life, because any relationship that I got into, I self-sabotaged. And it really impacted my professional life in that, you know, I was fighting with my boss a lot and I didn't trust anyone. So I was really screwed up for most of my life. And then I met my wife, and my wife, you know, had unconditional love for me. And then we had children. And then having children is what enabled unconditional love for me. And so I'm a changed person because of a family. But I also appreciate that I got very lucky. I won the lottery of life. I met like the most wonderful wife any man could have. And I have like three wonderful children that's forever changed my life for the better. And I would just say that for like ordinary people, I think like you have to make the commitment to family. So it goes back to the idea of magic, right? Like how was I able to find this my wife? And the answer is, well, I think I manifested it. I mean, like I said to myself, I want nothing in my life. I don't want fame. I don't want fortune. I don't want power. All I want is a family. And once you commit yourself to that, right, then the universe will respond. And I'll talk more about this in the cult series, like how you can actually manifest what you want. But you basically have to visualize this and make the commitment to it. And it's not an easy thing. Like I waited like, you know, 20 years to find my wife, but eventually I found her because I was willing to make sacrifices necessary in order to find my wife. For example, not choosing a path of wealth, of power, of fame. Because if I chose that, there was no way I could have met the woman of my dreams, who I truly loved. So great question, but we'll discuss this more. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Shannon. Okay. Moyak, sorry, I Moyak.
Yes. Hello. My name is Moyak. Yes.
Yes.
I had a question about we were talking a little bit earlier about the occult and all that stuff, but I had more a question more about eschatology. What we said before is that you think it's good to teach children early on, like about Taoism, about all these different religions. But I think also, I think that's very very good to teach children that way, to open up their mind. But I also think it can be really dangerous to teach children, because when you teach children that this is the truth and they grow up like that, and then later on they, at least if they're lucky, they find out that actually it's all, a lot of it is based on assumptions and fabrications, they would have really difficult time to break out from this mental framework. So what I would my question is about eschatology. You talk a lot about eschatology, but I have the feeling that you're talking about it more from a outside perspective. This is what the Jews believe, this is what the Shia Muslims believe, this is what the Sunni Muslims believe. But I think, and this from personal experience, is that you really had to live in eschatology, you really had to live in occult to really experience how it can change your life and how it can change your perspective. So for me, I had to really like throw out all the assumptions, all that what is taught to me, and really gain evidence-based knowledge to be able to go back to the source and filter out what's right and what's wrong. So my question was more about how would you do this? You are talking about eschatology, and you're also passionate about it. It inspires your game theory a lot. What is your personal perspective on eschatology and about reality itself?
Yeah, no, I think eschatology is really interesting, and I could do an entire series on it. But I'll make certain points about eschatology. Okay, so I think first of all, eschatology comes to us from a certain tradition, the Proto-Indo-European tradition, which then came to take over Europe, Iran, and India. And so if you look at East Asia, we're not eschatological at all. Okay, we don't. And the reason why is that the Proto-Indo-Europeans believed the world started with violence, right? So if you look at Proto-Indo-European mythology, it's always like these brothers, these twins who kill each other in order to claim power. And this is embedded in much of European culture, right? So in Rome, you have Romulus killing his brother Remus in order to become king of Rome. And the problem is, like, if the world begins with violence, it must end with violence as well, right? That has to be logically true. If the world starts with violence, then it must end with violence as well. So eschatology comes from the fact that you believe the world is based on violence. But there are lots of cultures, for example, in China, we don't believe the world is based on violence. We're not at all eschatological. We believe, like, the world can be balanced and harmonious. So that's my first point, that eschatology would be unique to Western civilization and is not global. My second point about eschatology is that it's a great way to motivate the people into action, right? So, for example, in China, you know, like, once you hit a certain income, right? Once you become wealthy, well, your ambition is just to, like, play mahjong every day. Okay, you're not that ambitious after a certain threshold. But in the West, people aren't like that. If you're really wealthy, it's often because you want to achieve a certain eschatology. You want to achieve a certain vision for the world. My third point about eschatology is that it is particularly effective when the world is declined. Because when the world is declined and people lose hope, people, you know, in the West, we call it quiet quitting. In China, it's called tang ping. You know, young people just give up, right? So what keeps young people motivated? Well, it's eschatology, right? It's a belief that you're achieving God's vision. So when a society is in decline, there's certain groups, for example, Zionists in America, who are particularly powerful because they're committed to a vision and they're willing to work hard to achieve their vision, whereas everyone else is basically giving up on life, okay? But I'll talk more about eschatology when I do my occult series.
Yes. So I was more I appreciate your perspectives, but I was also curious about because you were saying these are like the elements, and I'm seeing it. I am seeing it that eschatology is it's giving way to eschatology, and they are using eschatology in their societies, in their mind of way of thinking. But I was also curious about like your own experience in eschatology, because you're talking about being connected to the monad and all these things. What is your own perspective or feeling about, like, maybe a certain promise that has to be fulfilled or this kind of thing?
Okay, well, I will say this. When I was younger, I had many visions, and these visions stayed with me throughout my life. And I saw wars and fires and destruction. You know, like when I go to bed, I see like airplanes, like fighter jets, just roaming the sky and causing all this destruction. I see the world burning. So I think these visions are presented to me because I feel compelled to act. I have three kids, right? So I need to act. I can't just, like, you know, sit back. And I need to prepare the world for a time of war and destruction. Okay. So, and I think there are a lot of people like that. I think there are lots of people who from an early age are gripped by certain visions of the world. And these visions, they can interpret differently. You know, like, some are like, you know, I need to go achieve this vision, but some people are like, I need to present another path for humanity. And so I think there are quite a few people like this around the world, and these are the people who drive eschatology in the world.
Thank you for your answer. I had a very small other second question. Sure. Is about you were talking about having this plan of setting, like, schools, like educational institutions. You were soon also thinking about visiting Malaysia for this. I was curious about how this is developing and how you are thinking about setting this up, and how would I, or maybe some others I know, that be able to help in this endeavor, because we are thinking also about doing this, but we need a lot more help and support in getting this goal.
Yeah, so thanks a lot. So I would like to set up schools around the world to promote new ideologies, a new education system, okay? That teaches basically game theory, the occult, and the great books. And so what I want to do over the next year is visit different places like Japan, Malaysia, Europe, North America, and figure out places and people that I can work with in order to promote these schools. But basically, what I want to do is find young people such as yourself who are very motivated and who want to create a community to promote new ideas. So, you know, this Zoom discussion is part of the process, but I'll also be organizing meetups as well. And basically, what I want to do is work with people to set up these schools. So rather than like me have a vision and then you just like follow my vision, I want to promote ideas that help communities grow organically.
My community is based in Malaysia, and so I was thinking if you, before you go to Malaysia, maybe you can contact them and maybe help this idea grow into reality. So yeah. How would you be able to contact if that is the case?
Right, yeah. So I want to do a YouTube series on education reform and how to build great schools. And I want to use this as a theoretical framework for new schools of the future. Originally, I was supposed to go with Sneeko to Malaysia last week, but it got canceled because it was just too rushed. And so Sneeko and I want to go to Malaysia together. We've already agreed to do that. We want it to be as impactful as possible. So, you know, we're in touch. And we will definitely visit you in Malaysia, and we'll definitely have conversations in private about how to promote schools in Malaysia. And we want to meet with people like the Prime Minister and get his endorsement. Basically, what I want to do is create schools that educate the future poets, intellectuals, and thinkers and educators of the world. Because that, I think, is the best hope for humanity.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, okay. Jonathan? Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, great, all right. Thanks a lot for this opportunity. Actually, Professor Jiang, thanks for organizing this. Just, I was actually going to make a comment, but the previous commenter actually said something that really struck me. I was very interested in your alternative for your new education model. So a little bit about myself. I'm coming at this from a different place. I'm a thoracic surgeon in Montreal. I work at McGill.
Okay.
I'm an assistant professor, and I have a lab. I do tumor immunology. And so, I mean, historically, I'm sort of coming at the world from a very materialistic point of view, right, very reductionist point of view. And that's sort of how I got to where I am. But my last, I would say, decade in practice and probably 20 years of cancer research have really changed my worldview. And when I came across your videos, they really struck me. So, you know, what does, you know, your work and my work sort of overlap, have in common, that really struck me? And what's interesting is, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I interpret, you know, game theory and the predictions that you've made about the world as we live in it today, what I see is you're describing the world at scale, right? It's a different scale. And I think one thing that humans are really bad at is understanding different scales.
Yeah.
And different rules apply to different scales. And one of the things that has really struck me about the natural world is that nature repeats over and over and over again. You know, we're fractal, you know, our biological system is fractal. So a lot of these macroeconomic and macro societal trends that you talk about are governed by the rules of game theory. And that has allowed you to make these very astute predictions and made you quite popular as a result. And I think this sort of systems thinking that you've put out into the world is huge. And it's something that I think is severely lacking in universities. Mm. These places, these bastions of of openness and education, I'm a little bit, I have to say, disappointed in many ways. And what I'm seeing is that we have a very reductionist view of the world. And what's relevant to me in my daily life, I treat cancer patients, I do surgery for cancer, and I see people struggle with this disease, and I do research with cancer, and I work with pharma and all these drugs. And what I see is predominantly failure, right? I think I'm sure a lot of you in this group have been touched by cancer in some way, by your family, and it's devastating. And I think what's sorely lacking is this concept of openness, systems thinking. We have to stop thinking of ourselves as little machines. These are living things, just us. And actually, if you look, and I've applied a lot of your thinking to my own research, and in my opinion, and what I have seen fundamentally and objectively is that if you apply systems thinking to biology, it is very informative. It opens up a whole new avenue of thinking and understanding things. And I think it's very relevant to, you know, you said something like you want to influence people because that's the way forward for the world, to have this different approach, this openness to thinking, and that's the way forward. And I have to say, I agree with you 100%. I just find it extremely difficult to convey this. It's very hard to get people to change their way of thinking, even if it's a very minor perturbation in the way that we see the world, right? It's really hard to get people to accept a novel way of looking at things. Even my own students, sometimes they kind of look at me sideways, and then I end up right. And then, you know, they have to get their degree, so I guess they have to listen to me to some extent. But how do you get your message out there? And when I heard you talk about setting up these schools or these alternative models of education, that really struck me as something that I personally would love to be a part of. I think this systems thinking, this idea of thinking at scale and applying rules that describe reality as it is, not as we necessarily want it to be, is so important to get out there. I just wanted your commentary on that.
No, thanks so much. Yeah. No, I really appreciate the comment. And I mean, I'm really serious about promoting these schools because, as you point out, it's really important for people to look at the world from a macro perspective. And that's why I want to teach game theory. I want to teach the occult. I want to teach the great books on top of other subject matters as well. And as to my approach, I think what's really important is for us to have these conversations, right? Because now I understand who you guys are, and like what your thinking is, and this helps you better, you know, create a much more concrete vision for these schools. I also think it's really important to be patient, because as you point out, these ideas are not commonly accepted. But I mean, like 2 years ago, you know, it would have been unimaginable to me that I'd be this popular today. You know, like 2 years ago when I started this YouTube channel, I was like, my ambition is to have 5,000 subscribers. Okay. So the way the world has changed has just boggled my mind. And I'm pretty confident that in 2 years' time, the world is going to change a lot as well. And, you know, I'm continuing to make these predictions, right? So I got lucky. I made three predictions that Trump would win, that Trump would start a war against Iran, and that Trump would lose this war, and all three predictions have turned out to be correct. But it's easy for people to say, this is all a fluke, right? You know, like who cares, right? You just got lucky, you won the lottery, right? So I wanna continue to make predictions and show that, no, my theories, my framework has validity, right? So I continue to make these predictions. I think Trump will get a third term. I think that there'll be a national draft in America. I think, you know, Europe is gonna go to war against Russia. And so this is a way for the world to validate my ideas, right? If I'm truly a crazy person, then I'm completely wrong. But if my theories are going to continue to be correct, then that gives validity to my ideas. And so maybe you should start adopting my ideas. And I see myself as first and foremost an educator. I see myself first and foremost as trying to spread wisdom and enlightenment to the world. So that's my approach, to continue to meet people such as yourself and everyone in this group, to try to collectively come up with a concrete vision for how to reform education in the world. And also for me to continue to make these predictions to showcase my framework.
Thanks for the comment. I'll keep this brief because I want to let everyone, you know, make it continue to speak. But I would say you said, you know, you want to educate, and honestly, you've educated me in a lot of ways. When I look at this application of systems thinking, and I've really come to appreciate this concept of, like, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior.
Mm.
That's yes. sort of an adage that has existed for a long time, and we just sort of say it. It's almost a cliche, right? But it's not. In reality, what you're describing, what I see when you describe things is, if you take nature or the state of whatever you are talking about right now, as it stands today, the past, right? There's only a certain number of possible futures that are possible.
Yeah.
And you're describing it. And so, you know, I don't think you're getting lucky. You're describing a limited set of possibilities that exist if you understand the world as a complex system. And I think that's what you've done. And so I want to congratulate you. And it's been very, very inspiring to somebody like me. And I've been able to apply that across my work, which I didn't think I would get to at this point, right? It's like a very reductionist point of view. It's a very conservative environment. And it's very difficult to bring in, so oddly enough, bring in new ideas into science. It's actually very difficult to do. So thank you for that. And yeah, I would love to be a part of any educational endeavors you have in the future. And I hope to keep coming to these kinds of things as they keep going. So,
thank you so much, Jonathan. Thank you. And I hope to be in Montreal back in the fall. Like I'm from Toronto originally, so like, you know, let's try to meet up in Montreal.
Absolutely. I'll reach out. I'm McGill, so anytime, and I live in the Plateau.
Thanks so much. Jackson, Jason, Tucker. Are you here?
Hi. How's it going? I had a few questions to start.
Sure.
I wanted to open the discussion to some dissenting opinions.
Sure.
Not that I really hold any, but I want to know, what are some like significant events that could happen in the near future that would change your analytical model?
Yeah. Great question. So if Trump were to die in office, or if he were to resign, or if you were to lose in 2028, this would change my model completely, because I see Trump as almost like a Julius Caesar figure who has been propelled by the current times to assume power. Okay, so if Trump were to die and Vance were to come into power, this would change my model completely. Okay, that's the first major test of the validity of my model. Second major test would be Russia and Ukraine come to a peace, right? Because I see what's happening as just continuous warfare. And if Ukraine and Russia were to sign a peace deal, and that I'd be ecstatic if that would happen. It would completely destroy my model. The third would be if China were to invade Taiwan. If China were actually invade Taiwan, then I'm completely wrong about China. I'm completely wrong about the East Asia. And this would completely change that dynamic of the world, right? Imagine if China were to actually invade Taiwan. Well, then the United States is kind of screwed over, right? Yes. So I would say these are the three big things so far. And I don't think any of these things are likely. I think Trump will win and will get a third term. I think that this war between Russia and Ukraine won't expand over time. It will only escalate. And China would not invade Taiwan militarily.
Okay. And in these scenarios, although unlikely, do you have like, is this a shift in your thinking? Do you have a different like path forward in these scenarios? Or is it just open water at that point?
Yeah, great question. Okay. So if Trump were to die in office, then this would radically shift my model, because right now I think I'm using a lot of occult theory in understanding geopolitics. And if Trump were to die in office, then I think the materialist viewpoint would be much more valid. And I think the world would be much more random than I assume it to be. So if Trump were to die in office, then I would have to radically reconceptualize the way I understand the world. Okay, so that's Trump. If Russia and Ukraine were to sign a peace deal, then my very understanding of how the world works, it fails. I would have to like start from scratch if Russia and Ukraine were to come to a peace deal, because I can't see a scenario in my current framework in which they come to a peace, an everlasting peace, okay? So I would have to start from scratch. And then if China were to invade Taiwan, then I would need to completely reconceptualize how I understand China. Because from my perspective, it is impossible for China to go invade Taiwan militarily. The culture doesn't allow it. The bureaucracy doesn't allow it. The political system doesn't allow it. And so honestly, I'll be honest with you. If China were to invade Taiwan, I'd be very impressed with China. I really would be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. And then another question I had is, we talk a lot about like Plato's allegory of the cave and a collective consciousness. And you have mentioned in previous lectures that there are some sciences that are starting to like lead into this direction, specifically neuroscience.
Yes.
And I have a basic understanding of quantum theory or string theory. Do you think these are other like physics that point to this conclusion as well?
I think so.
Are your thoughts on that?
I would not be surprised in the next like 5 years, there's this major consensus emerging in mainstream science that says that, Plato's allegory of the cave is completely right. Like the world is what we imagine it to be. And you already have a minority within neuroscience which argues this point. And the argument is basically the universe is a simulation. It's a simulation, right? It's a projection of imagination. So I think this will be the economic consensus in a very short time, like maybe the next 5 to 10 years.
Thank you. And then my last question, kind of connecting to back to some other points where people are asking you for book recommendations. I think a lot of us are going through your lectures as well. And I understand that these are all very deep and interconnected topics. Yeah. And I would like to explore them more deeply. Is there a point in the future where you'd be able to get like a list of book recommendations that kind of follow your lectures, so we can take our own dive into this material? Or is it that you conduct mainly independent research on these topics?
Yeah, so if you go back to my Civilization series, I list books as sources. And on my Substack, if you go back to an early Substack essay, I will have book recommendations.
Thank you.
Substack. Yeah.
I missed that. I apologize.
No worries. Yeah. Okay.
That's all I have.
Okay, great. Okay. Karina?
Thank you.
Oh, and Cassie has the link to the reading list. In the chat. Okay. Karina?
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you for taking my question. I have been watching for quite some time, and I kind of got to this point of like reading from some of your videos. You talked about how Hollywood is kind of implicated in a lot of, like the movies that they make. They kind of show or depict ideas that they want society to follow before, you know, things happen, as well as, you know, like the government, like doing like false flag events and stuff like that. And I remember one video you talked about how like one, idea would be like, if they really wanted to do something that was like all eyes were on it, it would be at the FIFA World Cup games because everyone's watching. And I just, you know, just took that and went on to like, you know, ChatGPT, and I was like, can you show me the any movies that have any plot lines about any type of like terrorist attack at a sporting event? And I just wanted to like read the plots to see, you know, what came up. And I saw this plot line for a movie called Black Sunday from 1977.
Yes.
And it talked about a Palestinian group called the Black September.
Yes.
That took control of a blimp for a sporting event, and basically wanted to like blow it up and above like 80,000 people watching in the movie of the Super Bowl. And they were trying to, you know, kill the president and all these people, but they were saved by a partnering of Mossad and the FBI.
Right.
They were able to, you know, move the blimp and it exploded over the ocean. And the game was hosted at a Miami, Florida stadium. And I was looking up, you know, what's any, you know, games that are happening in Miami, Florida. And there's actually like one happening today at 5 p.m. And the finals are happening in the same stadium on the 18th. So that honestly kind of freaked me out. So I was like, you know,
yeah,
this is a weird, weird timing. I don't know what was going on in 1977 when this movie was coming out, but to depict Palestinians as these, you know, a terrorist group, and then yeah, to have, you know, the FBI and the Mossad be like partners that save the day seems odd, given our current standing with, you know, they're trying to partner our militaries and everything. So it's just like a very odd timing for it to just match up like perfectly. Of course, I don't want this to happen, but I just wanted to get your ideas on like how false flag events come to be and your thoughts on this plot.
Yeah, no. So when I was making a comment about, you know, like how the World Cup would be a perfect place to like do a false flag, I was actually thinking of that movie. I watched like, you know, many years ago, but it left a lasting impression because honestly, it seemed pretty realistic. Like, you know, if I wanted to create a false flag event and I really want to traumatize like the population, well, a sporting event would be the ideal place because, as you point out, there's like 80,000 people in a stadium and they're a captive audience, right? So if you were to set off a bomb in a sporting event, you could kill a lot of people. And the World Cup right now is like if you want to create a false flag event, the World Cup right now will be the ideal place to do it, right? When I teach your cult, I will talk more about these false flags because they're clearly rituals, right? If you look at 9/11, if you look at the Charlie Kirk assassination, if you look at JFK, they're rituals. They're like clearly the people who are doing this, they're trying to almost summon demons. They're trying to implant. It's a magic ritual. It's magic. That's what it is. So the involvement of Hollywood, it's speculative. I don't really know. But I will point out that Hollywood is heavily, heavily penetrated by Mossad, right? So, you know, like I saw on Twitter, like when Messi got married at age 30, it was the Israelis, the Mossad, who provided security for that wedding, right? And if you just go into like Hollywood and you look at who these bodyguards are for these like these A-list actors like Brad Pitt, they are Mossad, they are IDF, they are people who are very closely affiliated with the state of Israel. So does that translate into predictive programming? Does it mean that Mossad and Israel will get really favorable coverage in Hollywood and in television? I think absolutely. So the connections are there, and how they actually work is something that I'm still working on. Any more questions, Karina? Well, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it really does make sense. Thank you for, you know, adding to that. I was trying to get other people's attention on this, and it was so difficult. So thank you for having these meetings, because I was like, I need to tell someone that, you know, you provided a platform for me to be able to actually talk to someone about it. But I have a different question as well, completely different. I have been reading, you know, Dante's Divine Comedy, mm-hmm. and I did something that, you know, you said that, you know, there's a lot of like filters that really would help you understand the book more if you learn. So I decided to try to learn Italian, and I started transcribing line by line. Like it helps because I know Spanish,
right?
You know, line by line, like from Italian to English, because, you know, they have the Mandelbaum transcription. And I mean, honestly, even on the first line, like even if you don't know Italian, you just know Spanish, there's some words in there that don't really make any sense to why it was transcribed that way. For example, on the first line, where it says, you know, glory to thee, the one that moves all things and permeates, you know, his light. Permeates, that's the word that's given in English, but in Spanish and in Italian, penetra is penetrates. And I feel like that's like a pretty big like distinction to make, because if you think about it, like penetration is from the outside coming in, and permeation is like you're already in and you're just, you know, you've already spread. It's a static word, so it's not dynamic. And you, when you do a lot of these like translations from Italian to English, you start to realize like a lot of the words that Dante wanted to use are action words, they're verbs. Like he wants that to be like the common theme of like God is movement, God is action.
Yes.
And you know, if you were to emulate that, then you should be action as well. You should be movement, you should be acting. And I just, it does, you know, when I look at the English version, I'm like, it doesn't really come out that way. It starts to say things like, you know, glows, but the word is radiates, like it's like shine, like to the point that you like you can't handle it anymore. And I don't know why they translated it this way. I don't know if it was like their own style that they wanted to add to Dante's work, but I do hope that like others also, you know, take the time to like just translate some of these Italian words, because I'm only on like line 9, and just by translating it from Italian to English, it like really made me think and like understand the book way more than just reading it in English itself.
No, that's a great point, Karina. I mean, definitely Dante was a revolutionary. He was definitely a prophet. And he really believed that love is action, that if you really want to show faith in God, you have to take action in this world. He really believed in social justice. So you're absolutely right. And I mean, like each translation of Dante, each translation of Dante will be different, right? So I used the Mandelbaum translation because it was the most accessible. It was pretty, it's just pretty easy to read. But there are better translations out there. There are translations that rhyme. There are translations that try to show the complexity of Dante. So, you know, Mandelbaum, I think he chose accessibility. But, you know, like when you try to translate, you're only going to capture a small part of the total essence of the poetry. So, so I would encourage everyone to read it in Italian. So thank you so much, Karina.
Thank you.
Okay, Cassie.
Hi, Fraser. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. So, great. Thank you for hosting the meeting and all the YouTube videos. So my questions would be, would you actually believe like debate would help us to open our like our perceptions? Because I think from my experience, so I just moved here from Vietnam.
Okay.
And the past moved to Michigan. So I'm in US right now. And the past year has been a very transformative year for me, and I have to relearn a lot. Because if you know, Vietnam is pretty much like China in the way that we are very materialist and focus a lot on just, you know, getting a good grade and getting a good job and all of that. And I think that I'm trying to build everything from scratch again and try to rebuild my whole worldview again. And there are times when I try to share this with other people, or at least with like my friends or people that I know now. But I think when we try to have a debate, it's either two reactions. One is that they're just getting very angry because they attack their own worldview. The second is that they have a cognitive dissonance, so they just ignore it. So I don't know like how we are able to like convey this kind of message, or how to actually help like conversations that have both participants to like open their worldview in that way.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to convince people if they don't want to be convinced. But what I think is the world is changing very rapidly. and people's understanding of the world, it's being challenged, right, because of global events. So I would say it's very important to keep on learning by yourself, and eventually people are going to come to you and ask what's going on. And when they open their hearts, when they're ready to listen and you speak, you'll have impact. But right now, what's really important is to keep on learning by yourself and to really develop your own unique worldview. And that's what I'm doing, you know, where I want to travel a lot. I want to talk to you and others on this call. And I just want to keep on learning. So like when people come to me, I'll have more answers for them.
I see. Yeah, I think that's also speak to like my next question, because when we're in Dante, we have that part in Paradiso talking about the Francis and the Dominican, right? Where and in the way that they also try to do something good, they want to go out and act. I think that is the spirit right now, that there's a lot of people who want to act, but they also kind of see the world around them. It's that somehow all of this goodwill just turn into a bad thing.
Yes.
Somehow they're gonna be tricked again and got like, you know, everybody just turn out to be one, they just want power again. So it's feel very demotivated to actually act on it. And you become like kind of paralyzed in just try to live by. So do you have any like suggestions or any advice on that?
Yeah, I think it's very important to take a long-term approach. So rather than be like, you know, like I want to impact the world today, I think it's very important to keep on learning, develop your own skills to try to get involved in the community. And when the timer is right, then people will naturally look to you for leadership and for advice. So I think it's very important to just keep the faith, to think long term, and be patient.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, and sorry, it's just the last questions. It's actually, I want to ask about how you conduct your research in order to actually help, you know, learning by yourself, right? But there's a lot of resource out there.
Yes.
And there are a lot of different opinions and all of that. And some, and I would want to ask, like, how we are able to conduct, for example, any sources that you tend to like gear toward. There are any particular person or scholars or any places that you tend to gather resource for to actually, you know, form a framework, like able to actually learn that able to advance your learning, not just, you know, try to run in a whole discourse about everything.
Yeah, so I try to be very wide in my research. So I like listening to like Jimmy Dore, the Jimmy Dore Show. I like listening to Tucker Carlson. I like listening to Candace Owens because they will raise questions and topics that I'm not familiar with. And this will encourage my own research. So people like David Icke, Candace Owens, they mentioned Sapientia Francis. And so I'm just curious, like, who are these people? And start doing my own research. But it's really important to be as open-minded as possible and to engage with people who you disagree with and to really, like, try to expand your comfort zone. So rather than just, like, look for people who tell you what you already know, look for people who tell you things that you may disagree with or you may not know.
Okay, thank you so much. That's my
Thanks,
last question.
Cassie. Okay, Andy?
Hi. Hi. Hello.
Yes,
can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. Thank you so much. I am on Dante number 6 from your series that you launched 2 weeks ago.
Sure.
From your lectures, and I'm very emotionally connected to it, and I've been following your work for more than a year or so, and the Dante connection, the unconditional love, and I truly believe this is, as you explained pretty well on the number six, lecture number six, that I've been just this point that Dante connected you to faith in your journey, and I'm very confident to tell you that the same applied to me. I was a very skeptical person, scientist, engineer, rationalizing everything, and your in Denver, Dante's word has been very profound. I'm very thankful for that. I'm completely aligned with your education system ideas of developing this worldwide. And if you feel that the moment has reached to has approached to move to South America, Brazil, I will be very happy to host you. And I'm here doing my bit, spreading your message as much as I can. Even though Brazilians speak Portuguese, it's very hard for them to connect with English. And I'm very thankful that I spent many years in Europe, which got me to a connection with English that I'm confident you understand your message. But I am here daily thinking, how can we translate this into other languages also? And the education model that you propose is as vital as I can see. So thank you for creating all of this. This momentum is amazing, and hope to see you one day. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Andy. Thanks so much for that. Okay, Kevin.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, perfect.
Hi, just a follow-up question about reading. Apologies to people who are good at English or English courses. I was never good myself. But when you read books, for example, let's say like The Words of Jacob Frank, it's a very dense, complex book. It's hard to get through, and especially when you have other projects like work or studying. How do you dissect a book? How do you finish a book quickly, and so you can move on to other things and just take out key messages from that book instead of reading every single line? Because I assume that's what you did, instead of reading the whole entire book.
Yeah, so I read the whole book because I'm a very fast reader. I was an English major at Yale. So I've been reading books for my entire life, and I'm a very good reader. I'm able to read something very complex, like, you know, Jacob Frank's writings, and figure out the main ideas and figure out what sections are really important, because that's what I was trying to do at a place like Yale. And I would just say, like, if you're getting just started, it's very important to read it with other people. Maybe form a book club where you are, and maybe teach it to others. So reading is a very hard skill to develop over time. And I would just suggest that before you tackle on hard text, you might just start to get in the habit of just reading for pleasure, right? So every hour or 2 hours, just read for fun. And it could be, you know, comic books, it could be Stephen King, Harry Potter, it doesn't really matter. But once you train your mind on how to read, your mind is going to subconsciously pick up a lot of really important details when you encounter complex texts.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you have any more questions, Kevin, or follow up?
I guess just follow up. Like, so I assume you stay away from other people that is out there already that's analyzed the work. You like to read it yourself originally before you do that?
I'm a very good reader, so I'm able to just read it myself and figure out what's going on. But you're absolutely right in that, like if you're just starting off, it's actually pretty good to just read what the scholars say about the text. And it's a very good overview. You might even want to talk to ChatGPT and just get a brief summary of the text. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks
Thanks
a
for
lot, Kevin.
hosting.
AGM?
Yeah,
AGM?
hi, how are you?
Good.
Just a quick one from on my end. You've spoken about as several eschatologies in your courses and in your videos that might or might not happen in the future. Among them, is Russian eschatology. There's a Jewish eschatology with the Pax Judaica. There's the Islamic eschatology with the Iranian it's Shia Islam. There's also the American technate as well. Are these essentially a zero sum game in your point of view, or can they happen generally at the same a time or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's not zero sum. I think it's perfectly possible to achieve all eschatologies, right? Because if you look at the major ones, America achieves a technate, then you have Israel achieve Pax Judaica, the Great Israel Project. Russia achieves the Third Rome Prophecy. And then Iran achieves its eschatology, which is basically Pax Islamica. And these things are not actually in conflict with each other. They can coexist at the same time. And what I will say is that maybe in the future, you have many different systems exist in parallel with each other.
I see. And just a quick follow-up with that. Like when you're taking a look at the macro, and then when in some of the lectures that you have, you also talk about the kind of the micro, like to just introduce yourself to your neighbors, et cetera, and just to take those steps to kind of get ready for what is to come. The kind of link that or the stretch to take from the micro to the macro, it's quite challenging, I'd say. So what would be like your advice over there?
Yeah, so you always want to solve the macro because the macro gives you the framework, right? And the micro are just like specific instances that confirm the macro. So it's very important to have a conceptual theory of the world and then build on top of that.
I see. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a
Really
lot.
appreciate it.
Okay, so we have five more people, and then it's getting pretty late where I am. So we'll end the stream. Okay. So Leandro, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I have quite a few questions now, actually, that I've thought about. I want to start with more of a like a debate where of a topic that I'm unsure of, because like you talked in one of your very early lectures on like the dawn of civilization, basically, and there you said that before the people from the steppes invaded kind of Europe and Asia, that these parts were like all they were peaceful and egalitarian, but and that basically humans naturally are not actually violent beings. But then I kind of struggle to make sense of that, because then why is it that, for example, when a fight breaks out, like people are naturally, they seem to be naturally drawn to that fight to go see it, or when people get emotional, obviously angers are very strong emotions that can take hold of somebody easily, or also when the when Homo sapiens basically asserted its dominance over other human species. Like, that couldn't have just happened naturally. I have a feeling that, and that instead we have conquered these people like the Neanderthals, for example. So I'm kind of questioning how we could really have always been peaceful and egalitarian.
Okay, so that's a great point. And what I will say is the history of humanity is very, very incomplete. And the idea is that our brains have been like this for the past 300,000 years, okay, 300,000 years. Yet, we only have like 12,000 years of recorded human history. So what were we doing before we had like recorded history, right? So it's very hard for me to imagine like we were doing nothing before, you know, 12,000 years ago during when civilization just started off in Göbekli Tepe. So that's my first point. Second point is there's a lot of evidence that there are these hidden civilizations from us that we've never really fully investigated. Okay, so Göbekli Tepe is one example, but also like if you go to the Amazon, it's clear when you do like this survey of the Amazon, it seems as though the Amazon was made by another civilization. It was not the Amazon is not a natural thing. It was cultivated. It was designed. Okay, so let's say Amazon. Then you have these megaliths all around the world. Like if you go to Antarctica, there are regions where you cannot access, but where a lot of people believe that there was also a previous civilization. Then there's talk of like Atlantis, right? So I think that our traditional way of understanding the beginning of humanity, I think it's very problematic. And I think that over the next few decades, I think a new understanding of our history will emerge. And quite honestly, I also want to teach a course, do a lecture series on humanity, on like where we came from and on these ancient civilizations like Atlantis. And so that's number one. Number two is, to understand my argument, just do a thought experiment. Let's just say like you got like the 50 most violent men in the world, okay? And these are mass murderers, they're criminals. And you put them on a deserted island. What would they do? I mean, like you could say, well, they're violent, so they'll just kill themselves. But I mean, you could also argue, well, you know, there's 50 of them and they need to work together or they're all gonna die. You could argue like violence is just a function of the scarcity of resources, right? If you have overpopulation,
right? So it's environmental, basically. It's not within us, but the environment forces us then to be.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. That's what I would argue. Okay.
Okay, so it's really first of all that the history is just unclear enough to really fill in all the gaps of our understanding.
Yeah.
And that, like, if we humans existed in a vacuum, then we wouldn't be violent. Then we wouldn't be so violent because there would be nothing, like, there would be no emotions that would be, that the environment would trigger in us, basically. Okay, that makes a little more sense, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So I think over the next 20 years, there's going to be, like, a radical reworking of primitive human history. I think there'll be a lot of research, a lot of new discoveries that challenge the traditional framework that we have.
Yeah, and I also have just two really quick questions as well on reading again. And that is, how much time do you spend like reading a day, like currently or in the past? And like, how often also do you reread something, like for like if you want to refresh your mind either, or if you want to get like look at something from a new perspective, like how do you go on? And this can also be applied to not just reading on, for example, history or religious stuff, but also geopolitical research, like all kinds, basically.
Yeah, so I try to do 1 or 2 hours a day, and it's really good practice. And I'm blessed with a really strong memory, so I usually remember what I read. So when I do reread things, it's because I need certain passages to teach a class. And so I'm going to reread it in order to find a passage I need in order to teach a class.
Okay. And in the past, you also stuck to this kind of 1 to 2 hours, or has it been more?
Yeah, this is the best way to build your brain. Like, just do 1 or 2 hours of reading a day. And I guarantee you, like your brain is going to really expand if you do this over, like, you know, 10, 20 years.
And then you also focus on one book for those 1 to 2 hours, or do you also read 2 or 3 things at the same time?
No, you want to keep focus on one book. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I don't want to take up too much time.
Yeah. So Shannu has a question, right? So she's kind of shy. So I'll read her question for everyone. She asks, can you speak more about education reform and what are some resources to learn more about it? So I can go on for hours and hours about education reform, but basically my main concern about schools now is that they sap or they destroy students' intrinsic love of learning. So students are naturally curious, they're naturally motivated to learn for themselves. But because teachers are trying to implement a curriculum and they're trying to make students take tests, it's very easy for students to lose focus and to drop out, become demotivated. So it's really about appreciating students as a divine spark and really about cultivating their curiosity, really cultivating their passion for learning. And you can do that in many different ways, but the most important way to do that is to allow students to ask questions and to engage in debate and to structure learning around their interests. So that's Shannu. And then Alexander asks, what do you think about the space race 2.0? Do you think this is collaboration between China and America? Yeah, I think space is bullshit. I think we don't have the technology to get to the moon. I don't think, like, there's any point in getting to the moon. And I think that China and America are working very closely to create this illusion of the space race. China gets a lot of technology and science from America. And, you know, obviously China sees this as a way, like as a form of national propaganda of trying to rally the people in a time of economic malaise. But I don't think they'll get back to the moon. Okay. Okay. So Leo asks, Professor, what country should I move to if I want my children to grow up in a safe place with high quality life and education away from internal and external tensions? Yeah. Okay. So this is something that my wife and I talk about a lot, like where to move to. And the reality is that the world is going to shit, guys. Okay. There's no place you can go and be like, okay, this country is great now. There's going to be problems in every single country you move to. So it's really about having the proper mindset and really about building a community that aligns with your mindset. And so, you know, what I'm doing is I am going to go and try to find people like you guys and figure out how we can work together to build a more ideal community. Because the idea of moving to New Zealand or Chile and all your problems will be solved, that I think is a dead end. Okay. Hannibal asks, does Professor Zhang have any recommendations on how to avoid or escape the inevitable total surveillance state in the West? Okay, like how to escape the AI surveillance state? And what I do is I try not to participate in it, right? So try to reduce your online presence. Try to use cash where you can. Try to talk to people rather than write long emails. So the more time you spend online, the more easily you can be surveilled. Okay. So that's my best advice. But you know, the long term solution, of course, is to build a very strong community, and you know that's what we're trying to do right now. Okay, Jackson, Jason. Tucker, are you here?
Hi. How's it going?
Yeah. So did you have another comment or question?
Oh, I apologize. My hand has been raised.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Pedrin.
Hey, Professor. Thank you. I know it's almost midnight over there in Beijing, so thanks for your time. I wanted to ask you a question and just have you help me navigate, I guess, if you were in my position, how you would maybe respond to questions like this. So I was born in Iran. I'm currently in the Los Angeles area. So when you're in LA, let me know. Would love to meet up.
Absolutely.
And one thing I struggle with is, I would say probably the biggest portion of the Iranian diaspora is in Southern California and other parts of America, but Southern California specifically. And I have a tough time with most of my peers, especially my age range, cheering for the bombings, let's say, and other things like that. So I guess, how do you navigate the mixed eschatology in Iran? Meaning, I have friends who are like, hey, 4,000 years ago is Aryan. And then it was Zoroastrianism. And then it's, you know, Shia Islam. Is it cynical to ask, like, what is Iran or any country? Like, is it one or the other? Is it, to your point earlier, the world is what we imagine it to be? Is it just whoever's in power just kind of like picks whichever one they want? You know, his, the victor, you know, his story, they write history. So what is your thought on that? How would you approach that, answer that? I just have a tough time wrestling with that kind of question and thought.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say the world is what you make of it. If you really believe in your vision, you have to like think long term. You have to spend 50 years, 100 years to achieve your vision. And those who are going to work hard, those who are willing to fight and sacrifice their lives to achieve their vision will do so. So the people in power anywhere in the world are there because they're willing to die for what they believe in. They're willing to do whatever it takes to obtain the power.
Absolutely beautiful. And if I could just have a follow-up question, thank you for that, is how imminent do you think, based on this current game theory view, right, assuming nothing crazy changes, right, and it kind of stays its course, how imminent is a civil war in Bahrain, which would in a way kind of expand the proxy net of Iran? How does that look like? I think Bahrain is a country that most people don't think about. If you go ask like 100 people, they might not even know where it is on a map. What do you think about that?
No, you're absolutely right. So Bahrain is a powder keg because it's majority Shia and it's ruled by a Sunni minority. So the people are very sympathetic towards the Iranians, and the leadership, the elite, are extremely corrupt and very unpopular. So you're absolutely right in that a civil war will break out sooner or later. I can't tell you the time frame because America and Israel can still you know, suppress the people if a civil war breaks out. But I think that, you know, once America sends in ground troops into Iran, then all bets are off. Then I think, like, you know, the entire region may burn. I also point out that eventually what's going to happen is the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be destroyed. And this is going to cause a huge conflagration throughout the Muslim world. So a lot of people are expecting it. Israel has signaled that it will be destroyed at some point, and it's all part of the wider eschatology.
False flag. Thank you.
Yeah. Fred, then Dominique.
Yes, question here. It kind of goes similar with Hannibal there. With what we're kind of seeing on the surveillance side happening in Kenya, you know, you've touched briefly on Peter Thiel as well and kind of what he's doing there in Argentina. And I was wondering if you could kind of go into a little bit of the context that he's trying to create there based on what you've seen so far.
Yeah, so I don't know enough about Argentina, but I know Peter Thiel wants to create the network state, right? So basically he wants, like the way he thinks, he's very strategic. You know, he's like, I made all this money, but how do I translate this money into power, into long-term power? Well, basically I need to create my own society and have people treat me as a god, right? And I need AI surveillance in order to control the people. And so he needs to figure out where in the world he can actually implement this vision. And there's certain places in the world, right? So, for example, Gaza is a perfect test case, right? Because it's been flattened, it's been destroyed. The people are essentially prisoners. And the Israelis are an occupation army. So it's possible for him to try out his theory in Gaza. Argentina is also another test case scenario because the government there is very friendly towards Peter Thiel, and it's a very rich country, but the economy isn't doing so well. So a guy like Peter Thiel will try to look at different possibilities. He's also looked at something called seasteading, which is like to have your own city in the oceans, far away from other nations. So he's gonna, like, he's a venture capitalist, right? He's not gonna put all his money in one basket. He's gonna spread everything out, and he's gonna figure out, you know, what is going to have the most impact and generate the best ROI. So that this will be his approach.
Thank you. That makes sense. Further, seems like further auditions to come that we'll exactly. Kind of try in different areas. I appreciate it.
That's exactly right. And also Australia is a possibility as well, right? So, you know, Peter Field is a very flexible guy. Okay. Dominic?
Yes. Quickly, I have just a couple of questions that are more occult related.
Sure.
And we have seen that, you know, I don't remember in what one of the latest lectures in game theory, you said that with AI and all these new technologies, they are trying to summon demons, and then they're explicitly declared it. They're not even try to keep it hidden. And there are all these things going on. So we have always referred to these beings like gods, demons, angels, like external beings. But in your opinion, how much chance is there that instead these are structures within our consciousness, or how can I put it, like interfaces through which our consciousness encounters maybe realities that otherwise on its own could not comprehend?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And if you look at people on psychedelics, they say the same thing, where, you know, like on psychedelics, their minds open, and they encounter all these demons and angels they wouldn't have before. And depending on psychedelic, you encounter the same demons and angels. So I would say that our minds, our consciousness, are connected to infinite dimensions. And within these infinite dimensions are all sorts of like these different beings. So they all exist within us. And it's really a matter of like tapping our consciousness in a certain way that connects us to a certain demon or angel.
The other question is more historical, because geographically, we have many, many, many cultures in many places all around the world. But why do all these geographically separated cultures repeatedly produce stories of, you know, divine kings and forbidden knowledge and secrets, or sacrifice, a reset of civilization?
Yeah.
Why are basically discrepancies, but no differences, but it's almost like it's one?
I will go this into greater detail in the cult series, but the idea is game theory, right? Where society eventually reaches a point where it's a critical mass, there's a lot of people, and the elite become parasites on the people. And so the elite, like, how do they maintain control over the population, and how do they maintain internal unity, and how do they access secrets? Well, they do it for the occult, right? They do it for rituals, they do it for child sacrifice. It's very similar to what's happening today. You ask yourself, why is there Epstein Island? Why are there things like Pizzagate going on? Why is pedophilia such a huge thing in the world? And I think a lot has to do with the idea that the elite, in order to attain power, they make certain sacrifices to demons, you know, and it's all part of our consciousness, right? But it's a way for them to focus their mental energies. It's a way for them to maintain internal cohesion among the elite. And when you make deals with a demon, well, you have to make the greatest gift to demons, which are often children, right? So I think it's this game theory. I think it's just a way for the elite to access universal secrets, universal power, and for them to maintain internal cohesion and in order to continue to exploit the population.
But how come are always so similar between each other?
Because this is the most effective way to do it. Because if you want to rule for a long time, then you just have to use a system.
All right, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So I will answer Shannu's question and we'll call it for this first session, okay? So thanks so much, everyone, for participating. It's been great, okay? So Shannu asks, what are some things I can do to help find my purpose and help others find theirs? So I will just say, teach. Teaching is the most beautiful thing you can give to the world. So, you know, if you have time, go volunteer at a kindergarten. Go volunteer at a Sunday school. Go volunteer anywhere, you know, and just teach and be with kids and share yourself with others. And this is going to really open your mind to new possibilities. You know, teaching is the greatest joy in the world. So that's something that I would highly recommend everyone do. Just go out there and spread yourself or like share yourself with others. Okay, guys. So it's been a lot of fun. We'll do this again next month. Okay. All right. So thanks a lot and goodbye.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye bye.
Thank you, Professor. Have a good one.